Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! All fired up and ready to go. This is Head On. Got an email from Guy James earlier today saying that he was waiting for his connecting flight there in the airport at Hotlanta. Of course, you know, going to heaven or hell, you have to change planes in Hotlanta. Hope he got home okay. I'm sure he'll be up and ready for his Thursday show tomorrow afternoon. And what a great conversation that was just now on the Inside Scoop, huh? Oh, wonderful. And it makes me wonder. Makes me wonder if there'd be an interest out there for a little friendly hand of whatever in one of the rooms. We could probably have a heck of a good time if you guys are into that kind of thing. Nothing expensive, you know. Penny ante, nickel ante, whatever. I enjoy a good hand of poker. It might be something we could really, really enjoy. And maybe, and you know, shoot me an email if you're interested. Bob at headonradio.com, bobkincaid at gmail.com. It's easy. And, you know, maybe we could, depending on the numbers, we could get some horn hosts playing. I bet you Mark Levine would leap at the chance. And I think I could stand to get into it. Maybe even drag Agnes back here and get her in a poker game. Yeah, that could be fun. Shoot me an email if you're interested. Maybe we'll pull one together. So there's plenty to talk about this evening. Mark Levine is standing by. I haven't brought him on just yet. Because, after all, it's worth remembering that this isn't just any old day on the horn. This isn't just any old day of Head On. This is midweek. It's downhill to Friday. And, yes, brethren and sistren, it is, hallelujah, prayer meeting.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity, yeah. Whoever said religion should be free?
Oh, glory. Thank you. Thank you, choir master. Thank you for our offertory sermon there. And come on down, brethren and sistren. Come on down. Come down the blood-red carpet. Come down to the altar of this, the cathedral of common sense. Get your magic cracker and lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the rays of healing sanity flowing through your bones. Amen and amen. Hallelujah. Now, Mark Levine is, in fact, with us, because, Mark, you did that wonderful conversation with Jay Lakin from PokerSourceOnline.com, and, you know, I've talked to Jay before, and he's a great conversation, and I think, you know, it is the way you framed it, and, in fact, the way I framed it in past conversations. This isn't a poker issue. It's a freedom issue.
It's broader than that. It's an individual freedom. And for those of us that like poker, you know, hey, you know, torture doesn't affect my life, but poker does. No, okay, that's extreme. But, hey, you know, they actually ruined my game. I mean, I would like to sit back sometimes in the late evening when I'm just, maybe just before I go to sleep and play a short game of poker online. I can't do that anymore, damn Republicans. They're not just torturing people. They're out ruining my fun.
And meanwhile, Bill Bennett is sitting naked in a hotel room somewhere in Vegas playing slots. In a private room with a private machine.
You know, something, I didn't think I could have a lower opinion of him, but the fact that he was playing slots and lost $8 million playing slots, I don't know, I just, I didn't know how he lost the money.
Naked.
I learned something.
Naked. Naked.
Naked? What are you talking about, naked?
Yeah, I think that was part of it, too. Yeah, he was sitting there naked in his private VIP suite hotel room with his own little slot machine going, click, 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 click.
Are you serious?
Click. Yeah, I think so.
Oh, I didn't know that part of the story at all.
At the very least, you know, with a pair of boxer shorts on or something. I picked that up somewhere along the way.
That's just gross. That's not an image I want to think about.
No, you've seen him with clothes on TV. My eyes are burning at the mere thought. Yeah. You know, with his little
imagination is a scary
with his
thing.
little silk boxers with the poker chips on them.
Probably had elephants on him.
No. He had it. No, it was little silk boxer shorts with cherries and oranges and bells and bars and lemons.
Are you serious? Do you know this to be true?
No, I don't. No, I don't. But
okay,
I mean,
we can make it up.
No, but you know what? I'd give you 3-1 odds.
You're on. Double down.
If we ever get Bill Bennett on, we'll ask, and then I'll pay off.
I totally want to do a horn poker game.
Wouldn't that be
fun? A lot of listeners involved. We could do it maybe on a weekend when we're not on, or
yeah, nobody,
I don't know if we want to talk.
Yeah, and nobody going broke or anything.
No. I said in the chat room, we'll play for bragging rights, which I got to tell you are a lot more valuable than money. That's a very important thing. I can come in there. I am the king of horn poker, or queen of horn poker.
Yeah, being the horn poker stud or studette.
Absolutely. That and we all know how much bragging means.
I saw where chat room moderator extraordinaire ELO said it's one of the rare times she'll fire up a stogie. I will mail ELO a cigar.
Can you mail me one of those yellow ones that when you chew them tastes like banana?
Banana cigars. Okay, I wasn't sure. I thought you might have been into the green or the pink. Yeah.
No. I like the banana one.
Yeah, the banana. Yeah. Okay, gotcha. I think they sell the tobacco industry is so devious because I think they still sell the bubblegum cigars over at the local tobacconist.
That's where they sell them? I haven't had one of those.
Oh, you can't buy one in a convenience store or anything. They're, you know, I think they went out with Joe Camel and candy cigarettes.
Aww. You know, I mean, I hate tobacco. You know, no one hates tobacco more than I.
Yeah,
but
right.
but those of us who love banana bubble gum have to suffer because of all you addictive smokers. That's just unfair.
Easy. Just getting ready to fire up a cigar myself.
You're right, Bob. I'll respect your right to do it.
It's a freedom issue.
That's not around me.
Yeah, I lose my freedom around Mark Levine.
That's right.
Even if we're standing in the open air, I lose my freedom around Mark Levine.
Well, if you want to wear plastic over your head, I'll allow it.
Yeah, we'll put the plastic over your head. No, sorry, no, I'm all better now.
breathing is your problem, not mine.
So there is a bunch of stuff out there, and I got to thinking asking you to join me for some early part of the program when you were talking about all the stuff that is out there. That you weren't going to be touching on, and I thought, yeah, hey, this would be a fun time, just sort of throw some issues back and forth at each other, and I want to share something with you, Mark. You know,
okay.
I'm the one who constantly
preaches the pernicious effects of the right-wing religion industry on our body politic.
Right.
All right. I think you and I would probably agree, and most of the Horn audience, that Barack Obama delivered the speech of a career thus far yesterday.
He delivered a speech that will go down in history is as memorable as John F. Kennedy's 1960 speech. Absolutely. This was...
You
and
think?
I knew it would be.
You think? I still think that's a little over the top.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. When have we ever had a president that actually spoke out loud about African-American resentment toward whites, white resentment toward blacks, about the anger that is out there, and about how we can tie it all up and come together as a people? I can't think
and
of
anyone. And actually start trying to
Martin
heal.
Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
I'll give you Martin Luther King, but he's the first in our generation. He's the first since King to do that.
Yeah.
And to do it well.
And to do it credibly. To do it credibly.
Yeah. Right. That's true, too.
So I want to just... Sorry, I don't mean to... I want to just read something to you, if I may.
Okay.
This is an analysis of the Obama speech from the right-wing religion industry.
Oh, no. Oh, no. All right, I'm ready. I'm prepared. I got my okay. I've
got
safety.
You've got your anti-emetic off. The lid's
I found
off, and you're ready to
my
chug.
My safe place. I'm sitting down. All right. Okay. All right.
Okay,
give
yeah.
it to me.
Letting go now. Letting go now. Letting
him. All right.
Go.
All right. Okay.
Black conservative leaders believe Barack Obama did not go far enough in condemning the divisive sermons delivered by his longtime pastor, Jeremiah Wright. On Tuesday, Senator Obama, D. Illinois, delivered a speech intended to repair damage his presidential campaign suffered by Pastor Wright's inflammatory rhetoric. Wright's sermons suggested that Americans brought the 9/11 attacks on themselves and that blacks continue to be victims of racist whites. The Democratic presidential hopeful admits the sermons, now circulating on the internet and television, quote, rightly offend white and black alike, but went on to say, I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community.
Are they saying that blacks are no longer victimized by racist whites?
Yeah,
do they really? Is racism over? Because I want to have a parade. If racism is over, we need to have a racism is over parade, right? We won the war on racism. There are no more racist whites in the entire country.
With a nice buffet after, sure.
Yeah,
right.
That's what they just said.
But I've got a quote here on another machine that I can't get to this machine of Tony Snow. Remember Tony Snow?
Yeah, he was the guy that was hired by that newspaper run by that wacko Korean Reverend Sun Young Moon. Yeah, and he became our press spokesman. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, White House spokesliar.
Yeah.
He declared on behalf of the Bush administration, mind you, not as a private citizen, not as a lone wolf or a free agent or anything. He declared as White House spokesliar that racism is only a memory.
Racism is over. I swear we need a parade. I got an idea. Wait.
Can we have
the
parade in Birmingham with attack dogs and fire hoses?
No. Hold on. Wait for it. Because the image is coming in my mind. We could have George Bush, and we could have a burning cross behind him on one side, and, I don't know, pictures of Reverend Jeremiah Wright on the other side, and a big banner that says, Mission Accomplished. That'll
do
it.
Oh, you! And you say you don't have the gay gene for design, Mark.
He could even wear one of those dashiki robes.
George Bush in a dashiki. No, and he's done it before. There's historical precedent.
Right.
I think he had one on his last Africa trip.
Mission accomplished. Racism over. Cool.
Beautiful. So the article goes on. Jesse Lee Peterson, founder and president of Brotherhood Organization of a New Destiny. What? Brother? B-O... Bond. It always has to spell something. Bond.
Ah, Bond. Nice.
Yeah.
James Bond. Go ahead.
Yeah. Bond Market. Believes that last statement was a mistake. Quote, Barack Obama has received a lot of support from the white community because many white Americans want to put racism behind them, explains Peterson.
That's a terrible thing. Wanting to put racism behind them, white
but
people.
After,
why would they want to do that?
But after his refusal to denounce and walk away from the racist Jeremiah Wright, I believe this is definitely going to impact his chances of being nominated within the Democratic Party.
I believe he did denounce a lot of what the extreme things that Jeremiah Wright said, or was he not listening to the speech the way I was?
They didn't have to. This is faith. This is faith-based analysis. So there's another. Apparently, there's two black conservative leaders. This guy.
Who are they, and how much are they paid?
They are well paid.
Do we have details on that?
No, but they are well paid.
Okay.
Johnny Hunter, National Director of Life Education and Resource Network. That spells LEARN without the A. No, the A is there. L-E-A-R-N. Life Education and Resource Network. LEARN also says Obama is on the wrong side of the abortion issue.
What does that have to do with his speech?
I know, but wait. The screaming moment is coming. He says when Obama references the Constitution, he talks about liberty and justice. But he stops short of life. The very preamble he's talking about says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Without life, you can't have... Mark, stop it. Wait, stop.
Okay.
This is a quote from the national director of the... Pay attention to the words, Mark.
LEARN!
Life, Education, and Resource Network. LEARN.
He says another Declaration of Independence from the Constitution of the United States.
But wait. This is the quote. Without life, you can't have no liberty.
Great.
Just kind of makes you want to just, you know, call in all the chips on the Life Education and Resource Network, doesn't it? Maybe it should be just
Can we get one that spells
Life and Resource LEARN. So he's a pro-life advocate and he wants Obama to come out and say that he hates women's insides or something.
Whatever. Okay, he is meaningless. Who's the other guy?
Well, no.
You said there were two.
I did, and I gave you both of them. Jesse Lee one. Peterson and the guy who that's Johnny Hunter.
So black conservative one says white racism is over, and black conservative two says we can't believe Barack Obama on racial issues because he supports a woman's right to choose. Is that the summary?
Yeah, you've got the summary, except he left out the part about Bill Bennett, speaking of, you know, about Bill Bennett wanting to abort all the black babies. But, you know, we won't go there.
So I want
you to see, because all of these news stories over at this right-wing religion industry faux news site have comments enabled. And I want you to hear, Mark Levine, the comments of the Christians who have read this article.
Deep breath, okay.
Going to your happy place.
Yeah. I'm trying. You keep taking me out, but I'm trying. Go ahead.
If that was a sermon, then that's not a church. If my pastor harbored such ill will toward anyone or any group, he would not be our pastor very long. But then we are Christians. Obama is a lying hypocrite. That's hypocrite spelled without the E, sort of like potato with one.
Hypocrite?
Yep.
Okay. Like a hypocriter.
Obama is a lying hypocrite who bears no goodwill for USA. His allegiance is to Africa, along with the rest of the partitioners. I think he means parishioners, because partitioners are people who work on brand new hard drives. The rest of the partitioners of that viper's nest. The church website states that clearly. Okay, that's comment one.
Well, can I just comment?
His allegiance is to Africa. You've got that, right? Yeah, go right ahead.
I got it. Well, my comment on comment one is the guy that says, our preacher doesn't hate anybody. How much? Now, I'll bet, not 3-1, I'll bet 50-1 that their preacher preaches against gay people. I know it.
Okay, 100-1. This is a website that is run and operated by the American Family Association, which declared victory in its boycott against Ford because Ford wanted to sell cars to gay people.
Right. We don't hate anyone except gay people. Okay. All right. Go ahead. Yeah. Give me comment two.
Okay. Comment two. Even his name gives it away.
Oh no.
Barack Hussein Obama.
Oh no.
Comment three?
Oh, no. Yes.
I think one of the greatest parts to pull out of this article is that the Democratic Party defended a.k.a. supported, endorsed, agreed with slavery. What do you think of that, Mr. B. Hussein Obama?
That's true. 100-something years ago.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, it's, well, it's the flop. It's see, I keep working in the poker terminology, don't
there,
I?
There you go.
The Republican Party of 1860 is the Democratic Party of today. The,
you know, I'm
hateful,
willing to
support racist,
the Republican
bigoted
Party of I will stipulate that if I lived in 1860, I would be a Republican. Okay? You win. Comment 4, please.
Yeah, yes, comment 4. I will not sit down, strap in, okay? Y'all ready and everything?
All right, got my seatbelt on.
I will not vote for a man who chose the Koran over the Bible. I am not against him as a black, but as having an atheist mom and his lies, nor vote for a lying Clinton.
I can't even understand the... I don't even get it. I mean, okay, it's stupid, and it's ignorant, it's racist, and it's whatever. But, okay, he did have an atheist mom. I think that's true.
And it's okay.
I missed the rest.
It's okay to have a mom who's an atheist.
Well, it is in my view, but apparently not in this person's view. And, of course, he never chose a Quran over a Bible, and the rest of it just was incoherent. I didn't get it.
But the point is, he chose the Quran over the Bible. See, it's
yeah,
got.
When
the,
did he do that?
He never did. They're talking about.
Was there a game show?
No, they're talking.
Quran or Bible starring Obama?
Oh, too bad, says it. Alex Trebek. I know. No, this is the Keith Ellison thing. It's the deliberate conflation
right.
of Keith Ellison with Barack Obama, because after all, when you're dealing with right wing religion industry freaks, they all look the same.
And all blacks look alike, too, exactly.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's right.
Jesus, I feel like Bud Abbott here. That's what I'm saying. No. Hey, I think we got a caller here.
Okay.
Let's play.
Come on in, caller.
Hi, who have we got?
I don't know. It's pitching.
No. Third base.
Oh.
I don't know. It's third base.
I've forgotten the bit. Hello from rainy Nashville.
Well, howdy.
Hey, that's my hometown.
Yeah, this is our buddy David in Tennessee.
Hey, David, that's my hometown, Nashville, Tennessee. Glad to hear from you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Great to hear you kind of spilling over into Bob time. This is a beautiful...
Yeah, I kind of nudged in on his territory there.
But it was a happy nudge.
As far as I'm concerned, it's you're more than welcome. Well, I just earlier today, I heard a Republican strategery guy, a fellow named Whit Ayers, kind of, you know, lay one of the plans out there to discredit Barack Obama. In his little theory was that, you know, take this as a possibility. John McCain's minister gives a Man of the Year award to David Duke. Now, wouldn't the Democrats just be screaming to the high heavens? And then, of course, he went on and on and on to say, America had to pursue this connection to this evil minister that Barack has been involved with for 20 years and won't ask, you know, for an assassination plot to be lodged against the man. And it made me very angry because it let me have a couple of thoughts. First of all, the specifics of bringing up Farrakhan's name, bringing up David Duke. In my book, David Duke is much more the dangerous person.
David Duke was Grand Wizard of the KKK. David Duke went out and terrorized black people. There's no comparison.
He seduced stupid white people into ruining their lives by injuring or killing black people or other people of color or Jews, or maybe if they really wanted, you know, to win that month's toaster for the guy in the sheet doing the most, a Catholic also. So
that's all true.
Mostly Louis Farrakhan, who wants separation of people that follow him from the rest of the world. And I've got to say, much like some organizations I don't care for in the Middle East, there are people that eat well, you know, eat better, have a little medical treatment, get a little assistance and training in tough neighborhoods in and around Chicago at the hand of Louis Farrakhan. David Duke never, ever did anything like that.
Yeah, there were never any David Duke white people food banks or anything in Louisiana, were there?
No, no, no. So in particular, that argument stinks. And now then, I want to go straight to what I believe to be the real heart of this. As far as I'm concerned, Barack Obama's minister has never said anything that I could or should say is dead wrong. America is not a perfect nation. America makes mistakes. America puts itself into situations around the world that are only based on stealing resource or taking land or propping up a political ally that shouldn't be propped up. So, yes, we can and do make the rest of the world mad. And this man of about my age, his ex-minister, he's out of that church now, you know, he and I are about the same age. And it lets me hearken back to three things that have guided my thoughts about race for over 40 years. Well, a few times I actually thought of something I'm proud to say that came to me. First of all, in trying to figure out why black people, especially this minister, would be strident and say hard things and do stuff that makes us go, oops, oops, that's a dude, scary guy, scary guy. Look, folks, most black people and their parents didn't get here as tourists and decided to stay. Let's put that out there. Secondly, if you're a white person, just pull a Steve Martin. Think about being born black and how accommodating and how easy to roll over and how patient and how forgiving and how many cheeks can you turn before you say, that's it, I've had enough. If you're born black with your own aspirations that you've known all your life, you're denied doing anything toward furthering it. And lastly, fellas, and I don't like it that I see it this way, but I believe it to be true. When a person of color meets a white man, that person of color has no concrete reason to trust the white guy. You've got to get to know them. So when we're thinking about why black people can be strident and speak out and really go over the top, think about those three things. You know, you've got to understand where they're coming from. I grew up in Nashville, just as you did, Mark.
Yeah.
I knew black people that could say to you, well, when I talked to great aunt so-and-so who wore chains, she said this about that. I've stood there with my little 10-year-old mouth hanging open, and that ain't that far away. I can still hear those voices of people.
I heard the N-word many times growing up from white people in all-white conversations in Nashville, and I don't mean to pick on Nashville. I'm afraid I don't think Nashville actually is that unique. But
we got three Southern boys sitting around rapping here. It's okay.
Well, you know, it happens. And Dave, I do want to take issue, though, with a couple things you said. I agree, by the way, with the lion's share of what you said, and I definitely agree with the sentiment of what you said. I understand, but I think Obama put it a little better because I think that while understanding the anger, which Obama does, understanding where this anger comes from, you know, when you say things like, you know, have no concrete reason to trust a white person, that's, I think, what Obama's trying to get beyond. And yes, there is that sentiment there, but I hope we can change that sentiment in both white and black communities so that we're no longer looking at each other as the enemy, but as someone who is potentially a friend.
And what you've just said, I have absolutely no quarrel with, because we are right on the same thread, because one of the most important things Obama said, and one of the things that will get the least amount of courage, Obama said within the speech, he was disappointed that his minister was still stuck on older times and not willing to look more forward about America changing more. And
exactly.
Yeah,
but before America changes, don't you have to acknowledge don't you have to at least identify the problem?
Absolutely. And that's what Obama did so well. You have to know the past so you're not condemned to repeat it. Absolutely.
Thank you.
But there's a difference between knowing the past. I was just going to say, there's a difference between knowing the past, accepting the past, acknowledging the past, feeling the past, and getting beyond the past. I love the quote that Obama gave from Faulkner. And I like actually that he reached out to Faulkner as a Southerner, where he said, Faulkner said, the past isn't dead and buried, it's not even past. I mean, the past lives with us. The past is why African Americans and whites, who after all, race is just a construct, it has no real intrinsic meaning of any sort, but because of our egregious past, it does have meaning today. And I think that Obama is all about acknowledging the past, but moving beyond it.
Well, just this past Sunday, in a very cordial situation, a man 2 years younger than I, 62, it was a wonderful day. I had visited his church. We had joined his 85-year-old mother. That's just a dream to be around. And in the course of the conversation, the N-word popped up, and there it was. And I was just thinking, I just wish I didn't have to hear that. Of course,
do you want to just crawl under the table or something?
Yeah.
What did you do, Dave?
No. What did I do?
I'd be curious to know what you did and what other listeners do, white listeners or black listeners, when they hear that word in casual conversation. What do you do? What did you do?
In that situation, I let it go. And I let it go for one big reason. I do not want to, first of all, in the course of that conversation, the fellow that said it is in the midst of some health problems. And I know he was looking to me and to his wife and to his mother to encourage him at that moment. So I didn't think that was a really good time to do that. We were in a public place, which I consider more neutral territory, and I didn't want to challenge him in that regard with his mother sitting there, because I think the world of that woman. I've known the family for 62 years, so it's a little different situation. A more casual acquaintance, I call them on it right then. Or, no matter who's listening or who's watching or what the context is or what I've just learned about his state of health, if it's under my roof, everything comes to a halt, and I ask to never hear it again in my presence.
What I do, and I've you hear the word in all kinds of different contexts. Whenever I hear it, I have to say I have heard it less and less as I've gotten older, thank God. But when I do hear it, particularly from a white person, it doesn't bother me as much from a black person. But when I hear it from a white person, it sends a just like I feel like a dagger in my heart. It just pains me, and I think my face often shows the pain. And usually, what I say, because I'm not looking to get in a big fight with people, I usually say, please don't use that word in my presence again. And I just say that. And then they're like, oh, well, you know, I didn't really... And sometimes you walk away, and sometimes you just don't stay further. It's a tough thing. I don't know. Bob, what do you do when that happens in your presence?
I have worked harder. I'll be honest. I don't hear it anymore.
Really?
Because I don't put myself in places to hear it.
Well, that's what surprised me so much Sunday. It was completely I was astonished.
On the other hand, what I have dedicated my purpose to is in the raising of my family, is that word, and I've told my children straight out, you reject the word, you reject people who use the word, you call people out as ignorant who use the word, and you dedicate yourself to the fact that that word will, and to my knowledge, it never has to this date, that word will never leave your lips. That word will be an unknown word to you. And God help you if I ever hear it come out of your mouth. Because I told them straight up, I'll sit you down and give you a real good talking to. I'll ground you. I'll punish you if I hear some of the coarse swear words come out of your mouth. You know, the F word, the S word, blah, blah, blah. But I said, I will beat you senseless.
Oh, God.
If
Bob.
I hear that word come out of your mouth. And I mean it. I absolutely mean it. Because that word has got to be killed. Let me take you both back for just a second here, because you referenced the Faulkner quote, and I thought it was kind of interesting that he went to Faulkner.
But when I heard the Faulkner quote, you know, my brain works in a funny way, and I thought of another Faulkner line. And David, you may have heard this somewhere along the way. I don't know if you've heard it or not, Mark. Did you read a lot of Faulkner?
I did. I like Faulkner.
He takes some work, but you know, once you develop the taste, it's kind of like corn liquor, you know. Once you've developed the taste, you go back. But this is another seminal quote from Faulkner. He's discussing Pickett's charge. And he says, for every Southern boy 14 years old, not once, but whenever he wants it, there is the instant when it's still not yet 2 o'clock on that July afternoon in 1863. The brigades are in position behind the rail fence. The guns are laid and ready in the woods, and the furled flags are already loosened to break out, and Pickett himself, with his long, oiled ringlets and his hat in one hand, probably, and his sword in the other, looking up the hill, waiting for Longstreet to give the word, and it's all in the balance. It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't even begun yet. It not only hasn't begun yet, but there's still time for it not to begin against that position and those circumstances, which made more men than Garnett and Kemper and Armistead and Wilcox look grave. Yet it's going to begin. We all know that. We have come too far with too much at stake. And that moment doesn't need even a 14-year-old boy to think, this time, maybe this time, with all this much to lose, then all this much to gain. Pennsylvania, Maryland, the world, the golden dome of Washington itself to crown with desperate and unbelievable victory, the desperate gamble, the cast, made 2 years ago. And you know, Faulkner, the Faulkner quote, like I said, I thought was an appropriate usage. But then by the same token, you can also find in Faulkner, for every Southern boy 14 years old. I think you have to parenthetically add to that line, for every white Southern boy 14 years old.
Yep. Yeah.
Because there is, you know, I said a couple of minutes ago, just Josh and I said, you know, three Southern boys sitting around talking. And we are, but you know, oddly enough, and I don't know what I'm trying to get. Yeah, I do. If you say Southerner, by default people definition, it means white Southerner, right, David?
Yep. Yes, it does.
Yes, it does. Sure does.
And
I mean, I use it in other contexts. I talk about blacks as Southerners, but no, that's not the generally understood way.
No. And I think the line that, and that was a brilliant little line there, David, black America was not brought, did not come here as tourists and decided just to stay. This is a long history, and I respect Obama's speech immensely, and I think it was a brilliant speech.
I loved it. I'm not sure I agree with Mark on it being on a par with Kennedy's work, but boy,
it did remind me of Kennedy's speech, the religion speech, and when you stand it up against, say, Willard Romney's attempt at a religion, you know, the great Kennedy speech. You remember that a few months ago?
Yeah, that fell flat.
Arg.
Yeah, but this thing stood up and it soared and it had healing in it and it had acknowledgement. It had an element to it that was the. It was like the first visit of someone wanting to get well at a 12-step meeting.
Because
acknowledgement's the first step, right?
Oh, yes. And I felt at the very end, or close to the very end, I've heard bits and pieces of it all day. I need to sit down and read the transcript.
Listen to it. Listen, Dave, don't read the transcript. Sit down. It's right there. It's on YouTube. I have a link to it on my site, RadioInsideScoop.com. Click on it. Sit down for 37 minutes and listen to it. It shouldn't be read. It's too good to be read, in my view.
And you're exactly right, because Obama's speech in that situation is partially derived from the black church. And
absolutely.
I thought it was wonderful that it was a bit lighthearted in refuting and calling attention to the positives of his situation as a way to say, look, my minister said things I disagree with, but look, he's stuck a little bit in the past. After all, I am a black man running for president legitimately. It's not a civics project. He's got a very, very good chance to win the presidency. A black man I accept the idea that Obama, in wanting to reach out and understand, it's come to me a dozen different ways, that he is looking around and trying to absorb as much as he can of what the world is about, what America is about. And he's very, very unusual in that his blackness came from a free black man from Africa, contemporarily.
Right.
And his white, obviously very adventurous mother. And he, I think as much as anything, and I would never question how serious he is about religion, but I've heard it mentioned over and over, and I agree with it. He wanted to know more of the historical black experience, which, you know, he was not necessarily going to get that growing up. I mean, the man's got more in common with John Kerry than he does Martin Luther King.
I wouldn't say either. I wouldn't say either. This is a man from Hawaii. I mean, it's not the typical American state, Hawaii. A man who lived in Indonesia for 4 years. Yes, white mother, African father, but really grew up with his white grandparents who were in Kansas and then later on in Washington State. This is really someone. The irony is that Barack Obama, for all he talked about race, and he gets it, there's no question in my mind he gets it, he really does transcend race. He is post-racial. The irony is, for all the stupid conservatives saying that racism is over when it obviously isn't, Barack Obama's life is one of those instances, in my view, where he is transcending race in a way I'd like to see more America do. So there's just that wonderful irony there, that the one guy that can talk honestly about race with us is one of the few who have transcended it.
I agree.
David, thank you very much for your thoughts. We got a couple blinking here. I want to get in on the conversation here, but you know, I appreciate you stating things that frankly I think only get stated here and a few other places. As far as being done publicly, just as a parting thought, and I'd be interested in yours. I remember shortly after September the 11th, 2001, when a pair, not just one, but a pair of hard right-wing radical fundamentalist ministers,
yeah,
said that God had damned America.
Yep.
Not in so many words. Actually, they said God had pulled his protection like he was some sort of mob boss.
Yeah.
And, in fact, had caused September 11th to happen because this country has liberals and gay people in it.
Yep, they said the same thing Jeremiah Wright said.
But the only thing is, that was crazy. That was crazy. And I don't hear anybody comparing Jeremiah Wright to Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell along those lines. And frankly, Jeremiah Wright comes out smelling like a rose in that comparison.
Frankly, I've never heard John McCain condemn those statements by Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. He did say they were agents of intolerance.
Yeah, but then he gets invited to do the speech at Falwell University, and he's cuddling up to the hardest of the hard right-wing religion industry. And nobody,
John Hagee, too.
And still nothing. You know, crickets.
He wants to spoon with Jabba the Hagee.
oh, there's that one goes in the book, Jabba the Hagee.
All right.
If we ever have the money, I'm putting most of the listeners on the writing staff. Jabba the Hagee.
Well,
oh my God.
In the presence of the BS of Bob, you know, little plants do grow. So there you are, Bob.
Yeah, all right. Well, you know, I mean, but think about it. If you should happen to hear anybody talking about it, draw that comparison. Because suggesting that 19 pissed off Arab hijackers flew planes into buildings because of gay people and liberal people, versus suggesting that God has a hand in what happens to America based how one segment of America treats another segment of Americans, as between the two on the metaphysical plane, I think there's more of a chance of reality being on Jeremiah Wright's side.
Well, actually, let me just real quickly, what Jeremiah Wright said in an abominable fashion, and I don't support the way he said it.
See,
but
I do.
The logic,
I do support it. You can't mealy mouth this stuff, Mark.
Well, here's the thing. What he talked about in a generic sense, before you get to the anger, is things I've done shows on. It's called blowback. In other words, when you have an aggressive United States foreign policy that is going in there invading countries that didn't invade us and attacking people that never attacked us, there's going to be some blowback. They're going to come back to get us. That argument, which he made, is true. Now, he took it, I think, one step further with the, you know, goddamn America and all that stuff, which I don't think he should have said. But the idea that we have foreign policy that has consequences, that part is actually true. It's just the way he said it and the anger that I think went over the top.
It's the bombast that burns. The facts can't be denied. So let's remember that. And oh, don't forget, Katrina happened according to Java de Hagi because there was going to be a gay parade that day. So, gay pride parade. So, yeah. Are we hearing much about that? Don't think so.
No, not at all.
And actually, the French Quarter where the parade has was spared. So, God apparently loves the gays. Anyway.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, hey, David, thanks so much, man.
And the ground that Storyville was on didn't get hurt either, so there's a little retroactive help from above on that one, too. See you later, fellas.
All right.
Good to talk to you, bud. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Dave.
David calling from Middle Tennessee, and let's see who else is with us here. Hi, who have I got?
Hi there.
Hey, Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Well, hi, Mark. Would you like to hear Yankees' take on this?
All right,
please
sure.
Do.
Okay. I was also raised in the same generation as Obama's pastor. I can remember my father worked for Boeing, and he moved us to Virginia to put in some Bomark missile bases in Virginia. And little old me walked into the segregated South.
And?
I heard things that blew my mind. Just the sight of a white-only watering fountain just freaked me out. And I never did understand why I couldn't play with the people I wanted to play with.
Yeah.
But in a way, I was kind of inoculated because I come from a long line of rampant racists. My father made Archie Bunker look like a raving liberal. It got so bad that I had to threaten to fix it so that he would never see his only grandson ever again if he didn't clean up his mouth. And I wasn't talking about the swear words. I was talking about the racial epithets.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And he came by honestly because although she died when I was 5, I was informed by my mother that my father's mother was even worse than he was. She didn't just hate blacks, she hated Jews, she hated the Irish, she hated everybody.
Yeah. And that is not an uncommon ancestry in this country. And I think that's part and parcel of what Obama was getting at, but he couldn't say it with the same vigor, shall we say?
He did talk about his white grandmother and her fear of certain urban crime, shall we say?
Yeah.
Or I think she even said black men. I think he said that.
Yeah, she was afraid of black men. But what the point I'm getting at behind all of this was, I didn't disown my grandmother or my father. I didn't say to the world, this person is beyond contempt. I didn't stop loving my father because of what he was. He was a product of his time.
Yeah, I'll accept a certain amount of that because of certain factors in my own family history. However, to say that he was a product of his time and his environs, wasn't he, Susan?
Exactly, his time and his environment. He grew up as a Mormon in a small town in Idaho, you better believe he was indoctrinated.
And that's worth mentioning. You know, you don't have to start whistling Dixie every time you start thinking about racism in America, because
just look at the Mormon Church.
The Mormon Church didn't acknowledge that that African Americans were human beings until 1978.
You know, I was born
1978.
That's right, 1978.
And the thing that bothers me is about these right-wing religion industries, people saying he didn't go far enough. What do they want? Do they want him to cut Wright's throat on live television?
Well, that would have been a double bonus for them.
Enough.
They want him not to run for president, Susan.
Well, sorry, that boat sailed.
I was going to add to Bob's point. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. I lived there from birth till 18. And the first time I really ever lived outside Nashville, apart from summer camp, was when I went north to Boston. And I got to say, as much as I'd heard racism in Nashville, Tennessee, and I was shocked to see the racism in Boston. Boston, liberal city, right? Massachusetts. I was amazed. I had never seen such anger as I saw. In the South, when I grew up, It was, how do I put this? Whites and blacks interacted, but they did so in a way that showed white superiority. In other words, blacks
interacted in the same sense that upper caste and lower caste interact in India.
Exactly. In other words, the blacks would pretend to be nice to the whites because they kind of had to be, and the whites would use condescending terms that they didn't even realize were condescending, but they would talk, and they'd ask about each other's families, and they would actually relate to each other, although, you know, there's an old expression, I hope I get this right, that if you're a white southerner, it didn't matter how close you were to blacks as long as they didn't get too high. And in the North, if you're a white northerner, it didn't matter how high blacks got as long as they didn't get too close. And that was the difference between southern
uppity.
White racism.
The word you're looking for, Mark, is uppity.
Okay. Well, that's the difference between southern white racism and northern white racism. And when I went to Boston, I have to admit, I was shocked. I hadn't seen such separation. I hadn't seen such ignorance of simply, I mean, most white southerners do know something about the black church. I'm sorry, they may not, I don't know what they're talking about. How can they not know that, you know, at least part of the culture of the black church? One of the things I found, now I'm picking on the northerners, is that the northerners had less understanding of African American traditions, and whether it was songs or dance or it's the way or cadences, whatever it is, than southerners did. As much as there was no question racism in the South and a superiority complex, if you will, among the white folk, in the North I found, I guess, even more fear because people were afraid of the unknown and less interaction. And I was shocked by the racism I saw in Boston when I went there.
Yeah. You want to know what I credit for saving me from becoming my father?
What?
Mrs. Patterson.
And who's Mrs. Patterson?
God bless you, Mrs. Patterson. When I was in second grade, when I grew up, I wanted to be Mrs. Patterson. She was beautiful, and she was smart, and she was funny, and she was black.
Yeah.
She was your school teacher?
Yep.
In Idaho?
No, I grew up in Seattle.
Oh, in Seattle, okay.
You couldn't pay me to live in Idaho. I did it once.
Well, you know, I fear, you know, we sit around and this is always an uncomfortable conversation for me.
Yes.
Because I feel rather pontificatory. Ooh. I get that in Scrabble and it's game over.
I gotta check and make sure it's a real word. Bob.
I invent them all the time. Pontificatious.
That's worse. I like pontificatory better.
I knew you would.
But go ahead.
Because we're white guys, we're white people talking about, you know, why other white people don't understand the black experience. Doesn't that sort of...
No, I don't claim to understand it. I don't claim to understand it. I can't. I'm not black.
Oh, no, 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 no. I'm going to disagree with you, Susan. I'm going to disagree with you.
I can...
You can intellectually comprehend.
Yeah, intellectually.
You can be profoundly sympathetic, but until you've been pulled over for DWB.
Yes, exactly.
Until you've had those sidelong glances thrown at you. Until you've seen windows being rolled up simply because you're walking by 30 feet away on the sidewalk. You don't know it. And I don't know it, and Mark, you don't know it.
Yeah, and there's no.
I guess what I'm going to say is that as human beings, we can understand. We haven't lived the experience, but I don't want to say there's all kinds of prejudice and persecution in the world, and it takes different forms depending. You know, if you're a woman, you've seen some of it. If you're gay, you've seen some of it. If you're Jewish, you've seen some of it.
And you, Mark, to be fair, have got a little closer to the inside of it by virtue of being Jewish.
Absolutely, particularly growing up in the South. You know, it's interesting, Bob, I didn't mention this before, but when you said, you know, white Southerners, when you say Southerner, people think white, they also think Christian, and they also think straight.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah, precisely.
Because I'm wicked.
I mean, I don't think I can ever, look, I've never been in black skin, but I do think that we as humans do have the capacity to read and to understand and to listen. And I remember, going back now, I remember a huge discussion on racism I had at Yale Law School. And I remember, a black student say, hey, you know, you can never understand. You can never be black. You have no idea what I'm going through. And I said, hey, try me. Explain it to me. You know, I don't want people to sort of, the problem I have with that statement, while it's certain, in some sense it's absolutely superficially true. I mean, I have never been black, so. But what it does is it allows people to retreat into their victimization and say, you can never know what it's like to be black, so therefore I won't talk to you, you wouldn't understand. It's divisive, and
well,
I don't
that's
even
a, that's
really
a, yeah, that's an argument for not
true.
Trying to solve the problem.
Right,
because
exactly.
Because American racism, frankly, I think, needs to be treated with something approaching the 12-step process.
Yeah.
Susan, I've got a couple more blinkers. Last word.
On Huffington Post, there is an editorial by Frank Schaefer. The title is, Obama's Minister Committed Treason, but when my father said the same thing, he was a Republican hero. I suggest you read it.
Interesting. We'll check it out.
Son of Francis Schaefer.
Okay. Well, Susan, thank you very kindly, dear.
Love to you and Agnes.
And right back at you.
Bye, Mark.
Bye, Susan. Thanks for calling in.
And I hope this person has hung with us because, yes. Hi, who we got?
It's Gary.
Hey, Gary. What's up, man?
Finally,
a legitimate voice in this discussion, perhaps.
Black man, yeah. I'm going to break it down to you guys as close as I can what it's like to be a black person in America.
Okay.
Have you ever had somebody do you wrong in your life?
Sure.
Absolutely.
Okay. Imagine taking that around with you every day of your life, that you can never, ever resolve it, that you've never, ever put it back straight. Here's the other side of the coin. If I do something wrong, let's say if I'm a typical black guy, and I do something, I commit a crime, I do something wrong. Normally, if I do something wrong in my life, I can say, hey, you know what? I did something wrong. I can take 100% responsibility for it. And I can heal that because I did something wrong. But when you're a black person and you do something wrong, in terms of a perspective of oppression and being in a situation, even though you may be 90% of it, it's your fault, there's still 10% of it the society's fault, so it never ever heals. You always have something to look back and say, this is why I'm here. You almost have something closed, you almost always need 100%. So that's why this discussion has to also be addressed from the white perspective. other 90%, we will learn to deal with in a fair manner. And that's the whole complexity of Jeremiah Wright, because his anger is still bent in the fact that there are a lot of whites who have not come to grips with some of the oppression and the things that they have benefited from that was castigated against black people, put against black people. So therefore, he can never, ever heal until white Americans understand what they have done and express that to black people and apologize some kind of way, or at least show some kind of way that they're moving back forward. That's the situation, the most simplified way I can put it. And as complex as it is, that's what it is.
Well, you call it simple, Gary. I think it's anything but.
Yeah. I'm saying I'm trying to simplify it as much as I can, but that's the best way I can.
And I don't think it's insurmountable. I think it may be 300 years away. It may be 5. But the fact of the matter is, we have many parts of the rest of the world to look to, because those weird glances askance don't happen in other parts of the globe. At least not for the same reasons. And it lies racism. See, I believe that racism lies deep in this country.
It's in our history. We fought a war that killed more than any other over it. It is the American issue. It's what W.B. Du Bois said. I mean, that's the question of race. Gary, I want to know what you thought about Obama's speech.
I thought it was, I don't think I could have wrote it any better. I think it was almost perfect.
I agree with you.
I think that, you know, that guy is really, you know, he has faults. But the chasm or the opening that he put out yesterday, something that we need to all try to step through. Might be tight, might be hard, but it's something that I think, you know, all Americans should try to go through that, you know, that threshold, try to step through it. And I don't think we should be trying to, you know, close that hole back up. I think we should open it wider. I mean, that's why I like places like the Horn. I mean, sometimes I don't agree with everything said here. I hear things that, you know, kind of push me one way, but I understand there's a little different opinions on things. But I know that there's a level of trying to understand, and that's all you're ever looking for. Like,
and you know, you have. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay. Well, I was just going to ask Gary. To that extent, did Reverend Wright not serve his purpose? Did he not force and compel people to begin a dialogue, even if the dialogue is with a group of right-wing authoritarian Americans who cannot admit there's a problem? Do they not at least have to confront the fact that a whole bunch of people think there is? And by that definition, does that not make what Reverend Wright did good and right and honest?
Oh, I don't want to go there. I don't want to say that, Bob. Look.
Wait, Mark. Okay, okay, I don't know. What was... And Gary, I want you to jump in on this.
Let me put it this way.
All right.
I think what you're saying, Bob, is that his job as a minister or pastor is to bring the truth. The best way he knows how, he's an imperfect vehicle. But I honestly believe, from hearing him, because actually I have a little bit of advantage. A friend of mine used to go to his church. So I kind of know him a little bit more. And he's a little bit, probably sometimes, too political for me. But he's trying to bring the truth the best way he knows how. And I think that's what we should try to measure, as opposed to, I don't think he's trying to bring hate. He's just trying to, you know, he's just trying to bring truth. And I think that's what we should try to listen to. I agree. I don't like some of the things that he said. I think he went over the line in terms of the way making it palatable for people maybe in the audience to you know, to hear it. But if that's the way he feels about how he needs to bring it, maybe that's what you have to do. Maybe you have to just take a hammer and smash it through the window.
Well, that's my point. There's no nice way to get through on this. It is 2008, guys, and in 2007 we had no less than a half a dozen lynching incidents in the United States of America, and we're supposed to lily liver and mollycoddle and sugarcoat it and pretend it didn't happen? I'm sorry, I don't live in that reality.
But, you know, there was something in that speech, I don't know if a lot of people, I know you probably saw it, but he said something I think we've been talking about strategy with the Democrats, and he said something during the middle of the speech. I think he said, we can sit here and we can talk about this and that. And he said, and it'll be a distraction from us getting to the real issues. And then there'll be another distraction and another distraction. And I think what he was really saying, which I think a lot of people miss, was these wedge issues. This is what the Republicans do every time. And this is why I was saying early on with the campaign, when I was kind of concerned with, when I thought I saw one of the campaigns playing this little race card thing, I was saying that we cannot allow ourselves to get caught up in it. What we need to do is take ownership of it, throw it out there like we're doing tonight and other places, own it, because we have to take away the wedge issue. Because the 2004 election was about homosexuality. That's what the issue they used.
And 04 was homosexuality, and 2000 was guns.
Okay.
You know, when you have a foreign body, you have a bullet in your body, and they need to do surgery. In order to get the bullet out, you got to open it up wide. You can't leave it alone and just heal. You've got to open it up. You got to bleed more. It's got to hurt more. But to excise that bullet to fully heal, you got to go there. You got to go to the bullet. You got to feel the blood. You got to feel the pain. And only then can you heal. And that's the way I feel about racism in America. You can't hide the ball.
Because it was bold what he said. Because really, he put his presidency on the line with that speech. He pretty much, it was no political calculation. He just basically said, and I kind of disagree with him, that he had to do it because of the controversy. I actually think he knew, and he said it during his speech, that he was going to have to get that speech sooner or later. Because I think he understood the politics. I think a lot of people don't realize this guy's a lot smarter strategically than people think. I think he understood that the Republicans were going to come with the race issue. I didn't expect it in the middle of the primary. But I think
I said 6 months ago, Jeremiah Wright was going to be a household name, unfortunately. In fact, I need to actually apologize for something I said yesterday. One of my listeners caught me up on it. I'm a little late in this, but I had said on the air that I thought that that the Republicans were going to make Jeremiah Wright a household name, and every single American would think he was evil. And I want to be clear what I was trying to say, because I didn't express it as well as I wanted to. What I meant to say was Republicans would make Americans think that he was evil. Not that I thought he was evil, because I don't. I think he's flawed, but I don't think he's evil. But I Republicans would try to tar him and try to make him into this evil figure that he's not. I don't want to praise him too much either, though. I mean, Bob, when you say that, you know, he is the impetus, the spark for this, and it's a conversation that needs to be had. But at the same time, and I'll just throw it out there, and this is no attack on Obama, but it is an attack on Jeremiah Wright. One of the things he said was that the AIDS virus was a government plot put into blacks to kill blacks. And that kind of conspiracy thing, I think, does nothing to heal the body politic. Again, I don't think that, you know, that's one quote. I understand he gave thousands of sermons. I agree with Jeremiah Wright when he talks about the history of American white racism. There's no question that it's true. There's no question that it lingers. There's no question that there's hard feelings afterwards. But I do think he went over the line, and so I don't want to praise Jeremiah Wright too much.
Okay, well let me back you up just a hair, if I could, please. If Jeremiah Wright had said that the AIDS virus was a government plot, and had left out the black community, but had said merely that the silence of the Reagan administration allowed the embers of the AIDS virus to grow into a full blown conflagration.
That's true.
You're right.
That's a fact.
Right.
It's
the absolute the ignorance and the willful silence of the Reagan administration made AIDS HIV 1,000 times worse, not only in the United States but in the world.
Absolutely, no question about it. And the same is true with the blowback issues. He can say that American foreign policy is one of the reasons we were attacked on September 11th without going that extra step, which I reject, and saying we deserved it. It's a fine distinction. He could have gone 90% of the way, but he did step over the line. So I just don't want to praise him too much here, while I will praise Obama. But I want to hear what Gary's thoughts are on this.
Well, I would just say, do you think, how was the Iran-Contra funded? How was that funded?
Bruce, selling arms for hostages in Iran. We gave the Iranian government arms to release our hostages and then gave that money to the Contras.
There was a little bit more going on than that, Mark, and this isn't conspiracy theory. This is all testimony.
This documented fact. I mean, CIA was running drugs through L.A. During the 80s, and it went into Miami and other places like that to help keep the money off the books. And so that they can do this. This is how they funded it.
Yeah, planes that would run guns to the Contras, CIA planes running guns to the Contras would come back loaded with coke, Mark.
So I think what I'm saying, I think what it is, I think personally as African American, I think we have a little bit of a right. Now I would say almost a right to have a little bit of paranoia. I don't agree with the HIV thing. But I don't know how far I would go with it because, like,
well, Tuskegee is true. I mean, they did inject, innocent African American men with a deadly virus in Tuskegee. So there are, you don't have. I've always argued. I deal with conspiracy theories all the time.
Many people, just not black people. I mean, they've done that.
My only point on conspiracy theories is I think there's so many true conspiracies out there that are horrific. That you don't have to make any up. And frankly, you get a lot more credibility if you just talk about the ones that you can prove and the others that you can't prove. I think Wright did a disservice in that particular instance. I mean, the man isn't perfect, and that's fine. But I don't know. I'm glad he denounced Wright's comments. I'll just say that. At the same time as he brought us together for healing.
I agree you shouldn't. I wouldn't bring up anything against any government that I couldn't prove. I may think that they did AIDS, and I may think that the government thing might have been an inside job, but I don't think you should bring it out in a public forum unless you really have some kind.
Unless you can bring the goods with it. And again,
that's all I'm saying.
Again, let me just suggest that there is politics at work here, and anybody who thinks that there isn't, well, you just flunked politics 101 in America. And I have no doubt whatsoever. This is pure speculation. But I have no doubt whatsoever that somewhere along the way there was a conversation between Reverend Wright and Senator Obama.
Yep.
Where Reverend Wright said, "Son, let me be the lightning rod on this."
Well, Obama has said publicly that they had a conversation where, or maybe it was Wright that said it publicly. One of them said where Obama, it was made clear Obama was going to have to distance himself from Wright.
Did you say earlier something about somebody said on one of the right-wing blogs about something about Obama's going to try to have some relationship with Africa?
Yeah, I got it right here in front of me, Gary.
Okay.
Let me see. I can pull it right up. It's right here. This is the quote. "We are Christians. Obama is a lying hypocrite who bears no goodwill to the USA. His allegiance is to Africa."
That's just pure racism. Hold on,
let me understand this. I just saw Bush in Africa like a couple of weeks ago, and I want to understand, do these people who write these blogs would understand that Bush was just in Africa a couple of weeks ago, and he gave a big speech and said that America is committed to Africa.
So I know.
I don't understand where that's coming from, because that's the United States policy now, because Africa, you know, the stuff that we make, the minerals and the elements that come from Africa, we're in a strategic competition with China in Africa right now. I'm actually at the website right now where it says the United States Command, U.S. AFRICOM, is a new unified combatant command of United States Department of Defense to be responsible for U.S. military operations and military relations in 53 African nations. It's to be fully operational by September 30th. 2008. So I think George Bush is interested in Africa too.
You know, Gary, Jews get the same thing. They say, "Oh, Jews, they're more dedicated to Israel than the United States." It's classic anti-Semitism to say that blacks care more about Africa than the United States. It's classic racism. Look, of course, blacks care about Africa. Of course, Jews care about Israel, but we care about our country. We love our country, and you don't have to be either or. You can be both and. And that's why I just think that's just a pure racist comment.
That's a pure carrier. And, you know, they keep asking me, what does, Bob was asking this too, that what does change mean? I want to ask you this. What does winning in Iraq mean?
I've been asking that question for precisely 5 years now.
I got no idea, Gary. No idea. No idea.
You know, that's what I want to know. I think I kind of understand.
Sorry, can't help you. If you want, call in sometime when I got my Republican Mike Lane on, and we can ask him, because he'll give you an answer, but I don't have one.
All right, well, I'll call back when you guys get the answer.
Yeah, dude.
Call back when I got a Republican on, and you can ask him.
Right.
Gary, thanks for the perspective. I really appreciate it. I feel a little less strange about this conversation, frankly, because I ain't there.
We're on the same path.
All right.
You know what? It doesn't bother me. Thanks for your call, Gary. It doesn't bother me too much, Bob, I guess, because I was the token white guy on Black Talk Radio for a year, something I'm quite proud of, actually, a little badge of honor. And so we had these very frank discussions on race that I really appreciated, and it was very interesting for me because I was having frank discussions on race with a friend of mine from Nashville, with Mark Thompson, radio host, but doing so in front of a 90-95% black audience. So we were having these open discussions on race, but on, if you will, African-American turf. And it was fascinating to do that. And we got to talk about some hard truths, and I'm glad I did that. And so I believe you talk about race. You should talk about it openly.
Oh, I do too. But I am never going to sit here and try to describe the black experience in America. As long as I'm, you know, the palest, pinkest, whitest man on the continent, I'm just not going to do it. I can talk about how I feel about it, but you know, when people want to step forward, liberal or conservative, and talk from inside their white skin about what it means to be an African American in this country, I call BS in a real hurry. Because you can talk about it intellectually, you can talk about it about what the emotional impact is on you, but it ain't, you know, and with the caveat, Mark, that you've got a little bit, you've got some element of it that you can deal, because you're right, America is deemed white and Christian. Let's try another button here and see if our caller stayed with us. Hi, who we got?
Well, Gonzo, greetings. How's it going?
Well, hey, Spike, what's happening in Easton, brother?
Not much. We have the presence of the man who betrayed the American workers over a decade ago in the Lehigh Valley and the Poconos today, and Bill Clinton stumping for his life. May have gone the opposite direction of his limo on my way home today. There was a presidential-looking limo, but there wasn't a motorcade with it, but he isn't a sitting presence. I guess I came within the presence of someone I would have like to have towed off in person, but that's just me being an ultra-liberal. I got to tell you, though, I am really loving the conversation here about the Reverend Wright and all that, considering, you know, I live not far from Philly, where we, and also, by the way, I'm going to be relocating in about a month and a half to the Poconos, which will be the district where Paul Kanjorski will be going against Lou Barletta. Lou Barletta, a man who one time as a mayor bankrupted his city and had to come up with a new political strategy, so it became scapegoating Latinos and calling them all illegals and, you know, generalizing and being just totally inaccurate just based on someone's skin color. So, yeah, I'm seeing the other end of it. I mean, you go to Philly and you got Joey Vimto. By the way, and I know people always get angry at me when I point this out, but there's a huge portion of Italian Americans who are really become racist towards Latinos in this country, and it's pretty interesting considering there's a certain prejudice phrase based on their lack of coming here legally many years ago.
Spike, that's not at all unusual, because the nature of the power structure in this country for its entire history has been, you know, while the poor folks on the ground were, oh, he's black, oh, he's white. The power elite has always said, what they don't understand is they're all poor and they're going to stay that way. Because we're going to keep them divided.
Even look at the world of sports. I mean, you know, there's a lot of NASCAR fans who don't like Juan Pablo Montoya just because he's not white, essentially. Whether they want it, they know it or not. Some of them are foolish enough they don't even realize it. Why it is, like, I mean, why they're so bent out of shape for a, quote, foreign brand in Toyota coming, but yet when the German-owned Mopar Dodge came, They didn't have a problem when white foreigners owned the car company that came in. It was when the Japanese.
And again, it goes way back in American history. When Jack Johnson was beating the snot out of everybody who got in the ring, the newspaper sports writers coined the term a great white hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
They wanted some white guy to get in and beat up Jack Johnson.
Yeah, well, you know,
not because Jack Johnson was mean or evil, but because Jack Johnson was an African-American who was living his life on his terms, and as I noted the other night, it's why he got taken down on the Mann Act.
Yeah, there was always also a rumor, allegedly, that in the first Rocky movie, originally Mickey was supposed to be a lot more racist, to the point that he yells out to Rocky in that fight against Creed, you know, show him, you know, the white race is superior or something to that effect, and well, that would have been kind of accurate for someone of that era and all and from that area, but they didn't go with it because, in a way, too, it might have unwittingly, you know, supported that agenda.
Yeah, ask yourself, though, could Rocky have been made and succeeded with a black guy playing Rocky?
No, because in real life there was a Rocky by the name of Larry Holmes who's quickly become one of the most forgotten heavyweight champions of all time.
Well, see, I know you're calling from Easton, and that's why I asked the question I asked.
It never would have happened.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about a guy who is clearly ignored and his greatness and what he's done. I mean, the only thing people remember about him is the comments about Rocky Marciano, you know. Kind of interesting, you know, what everyone took out of the whole Larry Holmes deal. And considering how terrible boxing is anymore, I mean, I wish I could go back in time and watch his title.
Oh, you go back and see, Mark, just to let you in on the inside of the gig, Spike is calling from Easton, P.A. Easton, PA is the home of Larry Holmes, who was in his heyday referred to as the Easton Assassin. And he was a tremendous boxer. And this is along about the same time as the movie Rocky. And Larry Holmes is, Spike's right, Larry Holmes is just a non-entity. You see George Foreman's name out there because he's selling a stinking home grill.
Hey, it works. I got that home grill. I like that grill.
How did I know?
Don't pick on the grill.
And he's forgotten for his
boxing.
Don't hate
the grill.
As well.
Yeah, and George Foreman's forgotten for his boxing, and we don't remember the hellish existence he created for Muhammad Ali for what, 14 rounds, was it?
Some of that, yeah, certainly, yeah. Ali paid the price ultimately later on down the road for that, but
because Foreman beat him senseless.
Yeah, literally.
What happened?
No, gentlemen, I hear all this boxing talk from other people too, and I'm just gonna. I'm sorry to throw cold water on it.
You don't get it. You don't like it. I
hate it. I hate it. It's just pure violence. I know their strategy. I know. It's America. Y'all want to watch boxing? Fine.
Now boxing stinks now. Boxing is like pro wrestling now.
Yeah, mixed martial arts has actually surpassed it in the American culture at this point.
I just don't like people making other people bleed. You know, I don't mind if you want to, I don't know, kick or wrestle or... I'm such a wimp.
No. Boxing turned a corner with Wonsook Kim. Remember him? Remember him, Spike?
I missed the name?
Wonsook Kim.
I vaguely remember the name.
That's the guy. That's the guy who got punched to death in the ring.
Oh, yeah. I'm 28, so I was kind of young when that happened.
Yeah, or might have been kind of non-existent. I can't remember when it went down.
I think it was like 81 or something like that. I remember hearing about it not too long ago, yeah. Now I remember that.
Boxing, well, especially the era, it was what it was, Mark, and this is kind of evolved into a discussion of race. It was the first place where African American men were able to successfully compete.
I know. It's just
and it was that way because, frankly, we didn't care. You know, America didn't care.
People were getting their teeth hit out. Just play basketball, will you?
You did not just say that.
I know. Well, you said that where black people could successfully compete. Boxing, whatever. I know. I'm being the wimp here. I can't watch it. I don't want it. I don't like it.
I do. Sorry. I have to say, many years ago, on on the family, they had Archie Bunker make a comment to the fact about boxing, and it's essentially, you know, admitting to the latent racism of some people actually enjoying that aspect of it as well.
You had American people openly rooting for white German Max Schmeling to beat Joe Louis.
Yeah, Nazi Max Schmeling, by the way.
Nazi Max Schmeling to beat
not
Joe
like
Louis.
Germany in the 1960s, mind you.
No. And he did.
Yeah, and he was a terrible fighter as well.
And white America, and this isn't about boxing, Mark. This is about white America's attitudes. This is about racism. White America was thrilled with Max Schmeling.
Hey, do you also know, you know, I'm a big Phillies fan, by the way. In the 30s, the Phillies actually attempted to break the color barrier before anyone else, and Major League Baseball stepped in and over had a new ownership regime take over.
Yeah,
They radically overthrew the Phillies' ownership for daring to try to do that when the Phillies were the worst team in baseball and had nothing to lose. It wasn't even so much they wanted to make history or even give black people rights. They were just an organization that was doing so horrible, and they were so desperate that the Negro Leagues was their best chance to get talent. And Major League Baseball put the kibosh right on it.
Yeah, because, you know, and the history of the Negro Leagues, Josh Gibson, my God, Satchel Paige. Is baseball okay, Mark?
Yeah, baseball's fine.
Okay, just checking.
To me, when you talk about boxing, and you say that, yes, it provided opportunities for blacks, it did, but I don't know. I think so did minstrel shows. You know, so did, I don't know. Any sport where the goal is to knock someone unconscious, and I mean, I can respect wrestling, you know, okay? I mean, you don't kill someone, you just pin them to the mat. I understand force, and okay, and even some of the martial arts, some of the Asian things. Fencing, as long as you wear the mask. To me, it's the difference between fencing with the masks and without the masks. You know, without the mask.
You ever seen
okay,
how they do it in Heidelberg, Mark?
Well, I don't think I want to. If it involves poking someone's eye out.
No. They mask all the important parts of the face, but they leave the cheeks open so you can get these really sexy Heidelberg dueling scars. And the swords
and the swords
they fight with don't have points, but they have razor edges.
Yeah, not my idea of humane sport. Sorry.
But again, it's not about. See, with boxing, it's a particular history. Tell me if I'm wrong, Spike. It's particularized, though, because whereas in baseball you had brilliant baseball players like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson and the names are legion, but they had to compete in their own league, and the white people competed in the leagues where baseball players got paid a little bit more, and very rarely did the two meet.
Right.
In boxing, however, black men did get into the ring with white people. And it was the only example that America had, and it scared America to death. Jack Johnson and Joe Louis scared white America to death. I mean, basically,
how about this? When was this, Bob? What year are you talking about?
Well,
Jack Johnson.
Jack Johnson is the early portions of the 20th century, and then of course Joe Louis is fighting Max Schmeling in the 36 or so.
Okay, all right. Because I was going to say,
there's Jesse Owens.
That's what I was going to get to. That's exactly where I was going. You don't have to box to Jesse Owens. To me, is the real hero.
Now let me take you to a Jesse Owens story. Jesse Owens grew up in a little hamlet in Alabama that, frankly, I don't even know if it's a dot on the map. They put up a monument to Jesse Owens. They had to hide I can't remember if they hid it or put it behind an impenetrable wall because of all the people going and spray painting the N-word on it. Wouldn't Hitler be proud? Down the road here, and I mean down the road, right down US 60 from where I am, Mark, Booker T. Washington was born, a slave. And Booker T. Washington, a monument was put up to him. And the state of West Virginia had to move Booker T. Washington's monument to the Capitol grounds because where they put it, white people insisted on going and spray painting racial epithets on it. In another corner of West Virginia, Mark, they put up a statue at the Big Bend Tunnel to a real live African American working man by the name of John Henry.
Was he really alive? I know the
yes,
song.
He was quite real.
Okay.
And of course, when the Smothers Brothers were singing about him, or Peter, Paul, and Mary, or whoever, he was white. Had to be white. Nobody knew he was black. Well, as soon as they put that statue up, again, they had to do something about it because all the terrified white people had to go and spray racial epithets on it. And that's why people like Jack Johnson and Joe Lewis and Jesse Owens and Satchel Paige and Jackie Robinson are so critically important.
Just a second. I thought Harry Belafonte, I thought he did the John Henry song. Did he not start that song?
No, that was the Banana Boat song.
No. But no, he sang John Henry. I've heard him sing it. I don't know.
I grew, when I was a child, I heard the American folk singers, white people singing it.
Okay, I don't know who.
And then I ultimately learned the Smothers Brothers version, which is when John Henry was a little baby sitting on his daddy's knee. His daddy picked him up, threw him down on the ground, said, "This baby done peed on me, Lord God, this baby done peed on me." But that's another story.
Yeah, that's not in Belafonte's version. That's actually the only one I've ever heard is Belafonte's version. So I thought he created it, but I don't know. But let me go back.
Spike, you still with us?
Yeah. No, to be honest with you, I've never talked to Mark, so I've actually kind of been just enjoying listening to his take.
Well, thanks, Spike. Call in on my show sometime. Love to hear from you.
I rarely call in shows lately anymore, it seems. But, I'm definitely still with you. I've been really with you, especially some of the things you said about the Reverend Wright earlier as well. I mean, he has correct points, but he did go a little too far in some aspects as well. Considering how ultra-ly sensitive people can be sometimes when you say certain things a certain way, perhaps what creates the problem for Noam Chomsky being completely taken serious sometimes the way he goes,
I never take him seriously, but anyway, I want to go too far afield. I just want to get back to Jesse Owens, because to me, the image, when I think of one of the earliest images of blacks in sports and showing up white people, I mean, obviously, there's the Berlin Olympics and 1936 and Jesse Owens, and he didn't have to beat up anybody to do it. He proved he was the superior athlete, and he did so in a way. When I think about slap in the face to Adolf Hitler, it's hard to think of any in the 30s. Jesse Owens was one of the big slaps to Adolf Hitler in the 1930s, and he did so in a way that never in any way put down anyone else. It was about, his success. And so I would just, when I think of early sports heroes, I admit it's because I don't like the sport of boxing, but I was thinking Jesse Owens is
well. I'm reminded of something here by an emailer. Actually, Bob, in 1900, bicycle racing's greatest champion was a black man, Major Taylor, and in that time period, half the top jockeys were young black men, and they were the first rich black elite athletes. Very, very
now,
true.
Now, that I didn't know. That's interesting. I did not know that.
Now, compare, on the other hand, Jesse Owens with, I'm ashamed of myself that I can't bring the names to hand at the moment, but the black athletes at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. While it was Hitler who stormed out at the 1936 Olympics at the playing of the national anthem and the awarding of the gold to Jesse Owens for having bested his master race, in 1968, some black Olympic athletes raised their fists
black power salute
in the so-called Black Power Salute, and white America had a purple polka-dotted screaming hissy. How dare they do that during the playing of our national anthem? It's persistent.
That's probably also why white America likes Foreman, because I believe he was at that Olympics, and he was one of the African American participants who didn't take part in that, and
I think you're right, Spike. I'm sorry, Mark, you were saying?
Well, I just say they were banned for life. One guy was Tommy Smith. I forgot the other guy's name. But I know that they were banned for life from the Olympics.
Yeah,
for doing
that's
that.
What I said. A purple parka dotted screaming hissy here in America.
Right. I mean, the drug problems, you know, that you know, you might be excused for a few games. But raise your fist, Black Power, and you're
Yeah, yeah, let's not be getting uppity.
Well, you know, I two quick baseball references to Ken Burns' baseball. I've been watching it recently.
Love that.
First, there was someone in the 1800s who played on a team briefly before the ban was put in place.
That's true.
When the sport was two words, not one. And the other is Ty Cobb was involved in an incident where he beat on a handicapped fan because the fan heckling him called him half an N-word, saying he was half, you know, black. And Ty Cobb, anyone who knows about Ty Cobb knows, he basically beat black people for his own personal amusement. He was a very sadistic individual towards black people. And he beat the handicapped person unmercifully for saying that to him. He was suspended indefinitely by the league. Then his teammates didn't play for a game in protest. The league reinstated him, and then what they did is they fined his teammates $100 back in the early 20th century, $100 each for every game they didn't play in. I think it was one game most. But they only fined Cobb $50 because the guy did say he was half the N-word.
Jesus. Yeah. Oh, yeah. God, and we think that Reverend Wright was out of, you know, and see, this is what I'm getting.
Cobb's in the Hall of Fame, unlike Pete Rose, I might add.
Yeah, man, and unlike Shoeless Joe Jackson. My crusade. Hey, Spike, I got to roll around. Got him still blinking here. But, man, it's good to hear from you. Don't be such a stranger, please.
Hey, and call on my show anytime you want, Spike, all right?
Yeah, well, the bigger problem is my work schedule a lot. You guys are on repeats, and I hear you. So, and I would like to say two good songs for this discussion is WMA by Pearl Jam or American Skin, 41 Shots by Bruce Springsteen, because those also address some of the issues in this country of the latent racism we still don't want to admit lingers out there.
Cool. Thanks, Spike.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. Later. That's our good buddy Spike calling in from Easton, PA. I hope you guys are Mark, are you okay to just sit here and march through the phone calls?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay, cool.
I
got to
bow out at about 8 o'clock, but
cool.
I'm here till the end of the hour.
All right, well, hi, who we got?
You got David.
Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, I was just listening to the conversation. I heard Mark say he went over the congregation leader went over the line. Well, the way I see it, it was basically, you can look at it this way. If someone goes over the line, you basically just can walk out, and they didn't walk out. So obviously, a lot of people are feeling what he had to say. The second thing is that the minute you say that, Mark, you say, you push that line, and you say, don't dissent. You can't do that. What should be said is, yeah, someone has the right to say that, but we have the right to respond back and be able to, and what's happening in this country is that part's getting shut off. So,
Dave, I want to be clear. I never said Pastor Wright didn't have the right to dissent. He certainly does.
I think
he went too far. I'm criticizing what he said. I'm using my free speech to combat his free speech. I know there are people that supported what he said in his congregation. But I've never said he didn't have the right to say what he said. What I said was I was glad Obama condemned him as going too far. I think Obama was right, and I think Wright was wrong. That doesn't mean I don't think Wright did some good things or said some provocative things, or I don't think Wright is evil. I don't think he's anti-white. But I do think what he said was racially, as Obama put it, was racially divisive rather than bringing us together. And I'm glad that Obama said that he didn't agree.
Well, I think he was pushing the corner to do that. And I just want to mention that I can go through the reels, and we can go through the reels of anyone who's on stage and who talks for hours and hours and hours, and I can find you a soundbite of the same thing of any church in America or any place or any place in any environment, any building I can find that. So this, to me, this kind of discussion that forces us into this and saying, well, what he did was he was over the line. I mean, to me, that's BS. Because really, what it comes down to is people will be emotional and they can react in a certain way. And Mark, did anyone leave? How many people were cheering in there? There's a connection.
Well, I don't know what the relevance of that is.
The fact that people agreed with it bothers me even more. There's a connection there. You know why? Because it's happening. I can recommend something to you. You were talking about conspiracy theories, and this is just,
right.
I recommend you watching American Drug War. Now, when you see American Drug War, you're going to see that these conspiracies aren't conspiracies. They're legit and they're real. They got a scene in
some there. Some are and some aren't. I just try to make a distinction between the ones that are and the ones that aren't. I don't doubt that there were. I mean, Tuskegee is the classic example.
And with the cocaine issue, I mean, this stuff, you know, gets borne out, like I said, in testimony.
Yeah, now the CIA has done drug running.
What's interesting, and put this in a little bit of historical perspective, you know, one of my favorite comedians is, of course, Richard Pryor, probably the greatest comedian on earth ever, even counting Lenny Bruce. Richard Pryor had the incident where he was horribly, horribly burned while he was freebasing cocaine.
Right.
You remember freebasing?
I certainly do. Not that I did it, but I do remember how Richard Pryor got his face burned.
Well, freebasing was a process whereby you could call it crack on the fly because you were smoking cocaine, but the cocaine hadn't already been processed into crack. All right? And I'm not going to say how or who or why, but it is only after the CIA starts running cocaine into the United States during Ronald Reagan's Iran-Contra affair that crack becomes a prevalent form of cocaine in the American cultural landscape. And crack becomes a prevalent form of cocaine not in upscale white neighborhoods, but in black neighborhoods and black ghettos of the inner city, places like South Central L.A. And those are just facts.
But that's not what I'm criticizing Wright for. I'm criticizing Wright for saying that the AIDS, and I've heard this not just from Wright, but from a person that I've worked with and I like very much, in fact, and she gives me a hug every time she sees me, Maxine Waters. And I do like her, and she likes me, but I will still criticize her for saying the same thing that Wright said, that AIDS is a virus created by the government to kill black people. I don't think it's true, and I think that when you say things like that, honestly,
but
it hurts your credibility
for the
conspiracies that are out there.
But, Mark, can you not understand, and I think you do, how a segment of the population that has been deliberately killed has been subjected to horrifying domestic terrorism for 300 to 400 years could possibly look at that and say, "Hey, I can believe it."
I understand why they
made slaves out of us.
I get why they believe it, which is precisely why I think Pastor Wright's comments were irresponsible. You have an audience that has been abused, that has been persecuted, that has been mistreated by the government of the United States and the people of the United States systemically for 400 years, and they're ready to believe anything, and you throw a little spark on the gasoline that's not a legitimate spark, but an illegitimate spark, and yes, I think that's irresponsible, and that's why, yes, I condemn Pastor Wright for doing that. In doing that, I think in any way I take away from the real pain that these people suffer and have suffered and continue to suffer on the south side of Chicago. I don't think I do that by saying that I think Pastor Wright went over the line in making those kinds of comments. He didn't go over the line in other comments.
Let me throw a piece of trivia. And, David, I wasn't trying to just jump in on what you were saying. I think you're making very, very valid points. I got another email in here with a handy little piece of trivia that you might find interesting, Mark. In the 1936 Olympics that had Jesse Owens on it, there was a guy who was not allowed to travel to Germany to compete. He went on to be a Hall of Fame quarterback and had a long and illustrious career with the Chicago Bears. His name was Sid Luckman. Guess why he didn't get to go to Germany?
I'm shy. That's not hard to guess.
Well, one of the things I wanted to say that's relevant in this discussion, talking about the conspiracies and all of that, this is one of the things I jump on because, to me, conspiracies happen every day. And they're real. And when someone tries to say, slide away conspiracies, to me, that's a sign of a bit of deception and manipulation for the people who bring these conspiracies, who want these conspiracies just to be tossed away as myth. And one of the things in American Drug War that I found relevant was the director was talking to some kids on the street who were gang leaders. And he said, they said, man, they said, you know what? He goes, I'll tell you something. He goes, after 9/11, things changed. He goes, you think we wouldn't have wanted to move drugs on the planes if we could? He goes, look at the security now. He goes, why don't you take a look at my neighborhood? Look all across the block. He goes, who do you think's bringing it in? Director couldn't say anything. No one could say anything. And that's an open-ended question. That's a rhetorical question, basically. Because, Mark, the truth is, the people that are moving the drugs in are from this country, and there is a direct pipeline. It's been proven with a...
I don't deny any of that, Dave. I agree with you. I agree with you. Okay, all I'm saying is I want to distinguish between conspiracies there's evidence for, conspiracies there's not evidence for, because it seems to me that if you talk about, and I do this all the time, if I talk about on air about George Bush torturing people, that's proven, no question about it. George Bush lying about getting us to war in Iraq, that's proven, no question about it. Secret prisons, sending people to other countries to be tortured, putting people in jail without trial. All these things, you know, Downing Street memo, fixing facts around the intelligence, the Paul O'Neill's, dividing Iraq into various oil fields. All these things, I have absolute proven evidence, all of it, the stolen election of 2000. Now, if I say all these things, which are true and proven, and I bring in one thing that's not true and proven, I guarantee you, even if I've said 100 things that are true and proven, if I bring in one thing that's not true and proven, it will be used to
throw away the rest of it.
My credibility and challenge everything I've done. So what I would say is, I'm not knocking looking for the truth. I think I do it every day. What I'm saying is I think there's so many legitimate reasons to complain about the criminal and impeachable conduct of this administration, to complain about racism in America, to complain. I mean, you want to talk about the government putting a drug in to, you know, to hurt black people, talk about Tuskegee, talk about the drug war. All I'm saying is the thing that concerns me about some of these conspiracy theories is people mix the legitimate with the illegitimate, or okay, I take it, bad word. I take it back. Mix the proven with the unproven, and in doing so, I think damage the credibility of all the proven conspiracies out there. That's the point I'm trying to get across.
Well, you know who really opened this wide in the 80s was Gary Webb with Dark Alliance, and he proved it fact by fact, a direct link from the government. And I mean, there are things you can say.
Do you mean AIDS?
AIDS
or drugs? What are you saying?
What is that?
When you say a direct link from the government, are you talking about drugs or are you talking about AIDS?
I'm talking about drugs, yes.
Okay. I agree with drugs. I agree with you on drugs.
Okay, but I'm also talking about there's just because you read something, Mark, and you see it as a fact, you can go back to that book and you can disprove it. What I'm saying is when we're looking at these conspiracies, just because what you believe in fact in a book doesn't mean it can't be held to the light any time. It's the same thing with conspiracies. Yes, there are little holes in here and there, and it is a little bit shaky on areas like that, but that can be mendable. The same thing when you're dealing with historical text as well.
Yeah, see, I'm going to disagree with you, Dave, and that's okay. I respect you, and I've had this argument with other people before, and I'm glad you're willing to fight with me on air. But I believe there are such things as truth and facts, and the Civil War did happen, the Revolutionary War did happen, and, you know, you can argue on the margins, yes, about this, that, or the other. You can learn new things in history, no question about it. But I really, really fight against the tendency of some, and I'm not saying you do this, Dave, but there are some people, I think of it mostly with the 9/11 truthers, now a bunch of people are going to get mad at me, but with people who conflate legitimate concerns, things that are proven, things that are conspiracies, and things that are mere supposition. And you can suppose all you want, but please don't put, I just don't think you should put in the same category the proven and the unproven, because I actually think it harms the cause of fighting against the proven conspiracy.
It also helps. It also helps to work from an actual definition of conspiracy. All right, and you've probably had this as
well,
hammered
that's true.
Into.
I wasn't using the actual definition, which is a criminal conduct of people who work together to agree to do a criminal act.
Yeah, at least in the state of West Virginia, when two people agree to commit a criminal act, and one or more of them. I mean, you could have 100, and if only one, if you've got 100 in the agreement, and one goes out and takes what is referred to as a substantial step, then all 100 are guilty of conspiracy.
You know, Bob, that's why I say when people who bring up, see, it is a frame. It is a frame so we can never really talk about critical thinking of regarding this, these issues, regarding anything that happens in this government, because the word, the C word, always comes up. Mark, let me tell you. The reason why so many conspiracy theorists, or what quote-unquote, whatever you want to call, who doesn't obtain to what you're saying is history, is because they don't have a voice, man. You live in Washington, D.C. It's different when you're on the outside. There's a psyche difference. You know what I would call it?
You're right, Dave.
I would call it the same way someone lives in Las Vegas, right? They live in a different world when it comes to outside of where someone's living and not seeing what you're seeing. But you're right, Dave.
But I think that one of my goals in Washington is to try, at least I try my best, I don't always succeed, to separate what I know can be proven and what I don't know that can be proven. And I'm willing to look at new information. And if someone shows me evidence that the government
to be fair, Mark, some of this is also some of this is also lawyering, because one of the things you are taught first and foremost, or at least I, is never make a weak argument in the same lot with a bunch of strong arguments.
That's right.
Because the strong arguments never bolster the weak ones, and the weak one will always detract from the strong ones.
Exactly. If I make 10 strong arguments and one weak one, and my opponent will come back and only attack the weak argument and say Mark's full of it, he can't be trusted, he just made a weak argument. And people do it all the time.
And it works.
Standard way to debate, and it works.
Yeah. Hey, David.
So that's why I'm just real leery of unproven yet. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't investigate and prove these things. In fact, many people know I did a story a few months ago on the Horn. In fact, I'm trying to publish the piece now on a real life conspiracy that I can prove, where the FBI covered up an investigation into white supremacists and Islamic terrorists that were working together, and they decided not to investigate that because they wanted to protect illegal methods of spying on people. So basically they let the terrorists go so they could spy on the rest of us. Now that to me is not only a powerful conspiracy, it's true, and I can prove it, and I'm proud of the fact that I can prove it. So it's
a whale of a story. Hey, David, last word. I want to get at least one more caller in before Mark has to run along.
All right. I just wanted to say one of the best movies I've seen on race as of recent was Spike Lee's Bamboozle. I recommend it to everyone, and one of the greatest things that he did in the movie was he actually went from film studio to film studio and picked up all the race movies that no one wanted to see ever again, all of the cartoons, and the ending sequence is what he does is he strings it all together of all the scenes. You can see, like, the deterioration in all the cartoons. I mean, people had a hissy fit when that movie came out because the studios were so against him doing that, but in the credits you can see cartoon after cartoon of just stuff that would have been lost if he didn't put it together and put it on film just to show people.
Wow.
And Bamboozled is, you know, one of the interesting things about Bamboozled is the reason why Spike Lee was inspired to do this story on race was the movie is about black actors and actresses who get together, and it's basically a satire on what was happening with the UPN network at the time, and they decided to take it one step further in the cable arena, and they said, and the executive says, well, why don't you just paint yourself face black and make yourself have bigger lips? And it's one bugged out movie, but when you see it, it's so true to life, because that's exactly what's happening with UPN, and it's exactly what's happening with black comedy to a degree, and it's exactly what's happening with ET. And Spike Lee just nails it. So for all those people who want to see the best recent race take that you'll probably ever see, it's Bamboozled, without a doubt.
Great. Well, thank
you,
David.
I'll check it out. I like Spike Lee.
Yeah.
Thanks for the advice.
All right. Take care, David.
Later.
Bye now. By the way, Mark, David is our pop culture correspondent here on the Horn.
Okay.
And rolling along and hoping... doggone it.
They gave up.
Yeah. Hey, but, you know, that when you've got real live conversation radio, sometimes you're going to be on hold for a little bit. you know, just...
I'm fresh on this conspiracy argument because I had it last night. I was at the Take Back America convention, and Richard Green, who's an Air America host... had me on, and he is a firm 9/11 truther, and he believes that that Bush and Cheney sent people around to put electric charges in the World Trade Center to bring it down. And we talked about the how difficult that would be. And his response is the typical one I get when I talk about these kinds of things, which is, well, don't you think Bush and Cheney are evil enough to do this? And I say, yes, but that's not my point. It's almost
why
like
go to all
they,
that trouble when all you have to do is sit back and let it happen?
Well, exactly. I mean, I'll tell you one thing I am willing to believe, and I'd like to see investigated, and that's why we didn't have those planes up there scrambled in NORAD in time. That, to me, is legitimate. We scrambled.
They were just sent, and I mean, you know, I've played the tapes on the show. They were scrambled and sent out over the Atlantic.
Right. They went to the wrong place. Now, that's a legitimate conspiracy. That's something that we need to explore. My fear is, it's exactly the point you made, Bob, about strong arguments and weak arguments. And I honestly fear, and I've done shows on this for folks who've heard it, that there's a COINTELPRO-like arrangement. COINTELPRO, was when the CIA went in the 60s and would infiltrate peace organizations and civil rights organizations, and they throw in like one
guy who advocated
violence.
And Michael Moore did a lovely job of proving that that is going on with the infiltrations with Fahrenheit 9/11. Not supposition, but actual proof that, you know, there were federal agents who infiltrated peace groups. You know, we've seen the video footage
of
the Canadian government using its that wasn't the Canadian government. It was the government of Quebec. Using Quebecois police to infiltrate labor protests, trying to get the labor protesters to go violent.
Become violent.
Yeah, exactly.
To become
and,
violent.
And
what
it's,
it does,
it's there. So
it's a way, because they don't want to fight the labor unions, they don't want to fight the peace movements on their argument on giving rights to workers or stopping war.
They just want
so
to. They want to make them shut up.
Violent.
Yeah.
And I fear, and I can't prove this, and I can't say I can, so I haven't said it is true, but my supposition is that those that believe that electric charges brought down the World Trade Center, which is apparently the thing you gotta believe if you want to be a 9/11
right,
truther.
George Bush will put on his little black boots and his little black coat and his little black hat, and he planted little black bombs all over the World Trade Center. Yeah, I get it. And the people who want to believe...
I think it makes
legitimate
arguments look bad.
It really does. But the people who want to do that, who want to believe that, it's fine by me, Mark. It's fine by me. I take the John Lennon approach. Whatever gets you through the night, it's all right. I want those people to also understand that while they're looking backwards at all of that, that it makes it all the more likely that if that is in fact the case, that they'll get another one ready to go on a moment's notice. And while everybody's staring backwards at the smoking rubble of the World Trade Center, these baddies who were able to pull off such a monumental conspiracy will do it again. And because our focus was directed on the past, that they'll be able to pull it off again in the future.
It's also that what's going on now, not just the past. There is torture now. There is warrantless wiretapping now. There is an illegal
war. Oh, see,
you got to go
at 8 o'clock. I got stories.
Well, you'll have to tell them without me, Bob. But I've really enjoyed these extra 2 hours. I love being on your show as a guest. It's a lot
of
fun.
You're not a guest. You're family.
I'm a
co-host,
I guess, for the moment. Hey, thanks, listeners, for listening in. I'm going to be giving my take on Obama and Wright and his speech. You heard a lot of it already, but I'll go a little bit further about that tomorrow. And also, I want to talk tomorrow, about John McCain not knowing who Al-Qaeda is. I thought that was fascinating.
Or where they do their work or who their buddies are. Absolutely. Mark, thanks a million. Soon. Have yourself a great night, all right?
I will. Thanks, Bob.
We may have to make a habit of this.
I'd like that.
All right. Later.
Good night.
I love working with Mark. You will not have dead air, and you will not have pregnant pauses when Mark Levine is on the air with you. God bless him. You can drop the nickel in and walk away. If I'd wanted to, I could have gone and done a ham sandwich. I love him. I tell you what, jump on in. We'll continue the conversation. Or like I said, I've got some harrowing stuff out there. Some midweek sort of kind of stuff. And we can do that. It's all entirely up to you. This is America's liberal voice. This is the voice that is your voice whenever you choose to use it. And it is listener-supported. That also means you. This is the horn. And I wish my bumper music would play! Sorry, letting go now. I'm going to my happy place. And, yeah, okay, let's do that. God, I need a producer. You know, I just really do.
Silent Breed is people!
Yeah, I know, Chuck.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Wednesday was a National Day of Action against the Iraq War on the fifth anniversary of the invasion and occupation of Iraq by the U.S. military. A range of protest actions occurred coast to coast, and civil disobedience led to several arrests in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. In the San Francisco area, protests were held at the offices of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and there were also protests against military recruiters. In Washington, about 30 people were arrested when they blocked IRS offices. U.S. Labor Against the War added labor's voice to Wednesday's protest in Washington, D.C., as the Iraq War U.S. death toll approaches 4,000. As the nation faces protests over the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War, a group of Indian nationals are marching to Washington for a whole other reason. Jesse Russell reports.
Nearly 100 Indian workers who allege they were exploited through human trafficking between an Indian and U.S. company are marching from New Orleans to Washington, D.C. to hold accountable Indian ambassador to the United States, Ronan Sen, who they say has been unresponsive to their situation. The workers were hired by an Indian recruiter on behalf of Signal International, a U.S. oil rig construction company. The workers allege they arrived in New Orleans and have since been forced to work under exploitive conditions. The workers say they are launching a satyagraha against the ambassador. They contrasted their march with the salt satyagraha employed by Mahatma Gandhi as a form of nonviolent protest against the British salt tax in colonial India. The workers said the ambassador's response to their plight was to send diplomats uneducated on the issue of human trafficking who held meetings on company grounds under the company's watch. The workers have also asked for the embassy to put pressure on the United States to restrict travel to India for Signal's recruiters.
The International Labor Organization says the U.S. Labor Board's decision expanding the definition of supervisors is contrary to international freedom of association standards. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney says the U.S. belongs to the ILO and is bound to honor its principles. He says the Bush Labor Board's decision broadening the definition of supervisors to exempt more workers from legal union rights protections is shameful. The ILO released its decision in response to an AFL-CIO complaint. Jesse Russell has today's economic report.
Could the NCAA tournament be the final push needed to send the U.S. economy into a recession? U.S. businesses lost an estimated $1.2 billion in worker productivity during last year's NCAA tournament. 2006 was the first year that most games were broadcasted for free on the Internet. So now, in 2008, with streaming internet much more prevalent in offices across America, the estimate for lost productivity is $1.7 billion.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Wow, that was fun. Nothing like having your media players crash. That was not a PepCat problem. That was not the operator's fault. These things happen sometimes. Let's go to the phones. Oh, by the way, worker productivity. Yeah, that means more people working harder for less money, less benefits, and less pay, and less human dignity. So, guys, and it's mostly guys, but ladies, if you're into it too, feel free to watch the NCAA tournament at work. You'll get no grief from me. Not a bit. Again, let's go to the phones. Hey, Andy.
Hey, man, how's it going?
Oh, good, you?
Yeah, not too bad. I'm actually really, really angry with you and Mark at the moment, so if I lose my temper with you, I apologize in advance.
That's all right. I'm just not a 9/11 truther.
No, no, seriously, but if you refer to it as black boots and running around stuff anymore, I'm going to lose it, just totally lose it. You cannot be that dismissive, mate, seriously, because if you're like that, then I might as well be dismissive about something you care about, okay? So don't, okay? Because nobody that I have ever heard has ever said George Bush planted explosives in the World Trade Center, and if somebody said that, then they're an idiot, okay?
I've heard them say that he ordered it.
So? Maybe he did. Okay, this is the point, okay? Now, fair enough. If we're talking about conspiracies generally, there are ones we've got proof for and ones we don't. So if you're going to talk on a topic to people who don't believe in conspiracy, they think that the government just reels from crisis to crisis like a drunken whore, then fine, okay? You've got to hit them with stuff you can prove. COINTELPRO, Operation Northwood.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was going to mention Operation Northwoods when Mark brought up COINTELPRO.
To hold up, right? Now, let's look at 9/11. Seriously, I want you to listen to me and look at 9/11.
I'm listening.
Go back and watch those videos, okay? Don't worry about... Just find the clips of the buildings coming down,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Where did all the extra power come from? Look at the videos and ask that question. Where did that energy come from? Where did that power come from? Because when a building falls over, Bob, it doesn't explode. It falls over, okay? And those buildings did not fall over. They blew, and I'm glad we're on the web, they blew the fuck up. Now watch those videos and tell me I'm wrong. And I challenge Mark to do that too, because he's so glib and so dismissive, and he says, oh, well, there's conspiracies I've got evidence for, and there's conspiracies I don't have evidence for. Well, Mark, we're not going to get the evidence if we don't look at the conspiracies because you've dismissed them. Okay, and the same stands for you, Bob.
But one of my problems... Andy.
Let me say my piece. Maybe there isn't the evidence for 9/11, okay? But if we don't find it, if we don't look for it, we can't find it, okay? And everything that goes on now, the torture, the depleted uranium use in Iraq, the blowing up of wedding parties, the deaths of your soldiers, the deaths of my soldiers, all of that...
flows out of 9/11.
The modern lie of 9/11.
Sure.
Okay? Now, the 9/11 is the lie. Now, there'll be another one, yeah, for the next time, but we'll be even less likely we're going to prove that one if we can't get this one done. This one is the big one. If they get away with this, and you cannot tell me that a bunch of Saudi Arabians managed to get NORAD's planes sent off in the wrong directions. There's only a couple of people in the entire country that can do that, Bob. Who are they?
How about incompetence, Andy?
Yeah, okay, incompetence exists too, but...
I mean, if you go and you listen to the NORAD tapes, that's what I came away with, that it was utterly, unmistakably, horrifyingly, sickeningly incompetent. Now, we're on the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War. How much competence have we had out of our military, ours or yours? Yours probably not so much, but ours definitely. How much competence have we had? Not much.
Yeah, but Bob, it's in the eye of the beholder. If they're not trying to be competent in what they're doing in Iraq, then they're succeeding.
I understand the argument. I really do understand the argument. That it's incompetence if you're trying to succeed at something. Or if their terms for success are different from, say, the layman's terms for success, and let's assume that the layman's term for success is let's get the place stabilized and go the hell home.
Mm.
Theirs isn't that. Theirs is to make sure that they set up a puppet regime that is quite malleable and utterly, what's the word I'm looking for?
puppet. You know, I mean, that they will do as they are damned well told. Now, as far as the evidence for 9/11 is concerned, I fear, I mean, whether I like it or not, and I don't, that evidence is gone. It's been turned into computer cases and soup cans and all that crap in China by now.
Dude, it hasn't. There are samples out there that have been stolen at great risk to individuals and provided. And those samples have been matched with the original samples taken from the buildings years and years ago. And they've got the additional evidence of chemicals that are left behind when certain explosives are used. But you don't have to believe it, okay? You don't even have to investigate it. You've just got to stop dismissing it. And if people want to bring it up, let them.
I have never, Andy, not let someone bring up 9/11.
But the statement with George Bush running around with little black boots, that has got to stop, Bob, because you're being as bad as Bill O'fucking Riley.
Oh, now, them's fighting words, Andy.
You are. No, you are. You are. That is as bad as Bill O'Reilly. That's calling someone a pinhead. I'm really angry about this, but I've got to go because I've woken Hazel up and she's going to be really angry with me.
Oh, sorry to Hazel.
No, it's my fault, mate.
But, well, let me just throw one thing out there before you do go.
Mm-hmm.
Water seeks its own level, and it seeks the path of least resistance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Conspiracies tend to run that way, too. If you study, and I'm not talking about conspiracy theory because I hate that phrase. Because by virtue of using the word conspiracy, you, again, give people a reason to tune out and turn off. There are lots of real conspiracies. We were witness to one, you in the UK were witness to one with Northern Light or whatever that bank was that went belly up. There was a government conspiracy to make it stop. We were witness to one with Bear Stearns.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clearly a conspiracy. Frankly, it's provably criminal. But conspiracies tend to take the path of least resistance, just like water. Why do all of that when all you've got to do is let the attack that you know is coming happen?
Yeah, but this is my point. The argument of 9/11 is so complicated that to just dismiss it with that little statement you had is just unbelievable. Was it incompetent? Was it intentional? Was it part and part? Was one element of the government simply incompetent? Was one element of the government willing to let it happen? Was another element of the government that neither of the first two knew about the thing that did it? We don't know, but the question is there, and the question has to be answered, and that's the point.
Well, I have never suggested that it not be investigated. Yeah. I have never suggested that the 9/11 Commission did a competent job.
Well, you know, the people in the 9/11 Commission were the people who were in the Warren Commission. What happened there? We know that was covered up. So that just adds more questions. But I've got to go. I'm waiting for Hitler.
Oh, okay. See you, Andy.
Take it easy, man. Bye, man.
Bye now. I don't want to get on anybody's fighting side over this, but I have heard 9/11 taken to extremes that are so non-productive that they become counterproductive, and I've seen the right wing response to it. You know, I do understand. Yeah, there was a conspiracy. Look, there clearly, at least to me, there was a conspiracy after 9/11, and that conspiracy was to use 9/11. God, I hate that. No, a 9/11 is a beautiful piece of German automotive engineering. Damn it! It was September the 11th, 2001. And if we don't have time to say that, we don't have much time for anything else. 9/11 is what you dial when you're clutching your freaking chest. September the 11th, 2001 is a mess of conspiracies. I have no doubt that from the NSA, how many different intelligence agencies do we have? Every last one of them has been in on it to one degree or another. No doubt. There was clearly a conspiracy between the CIA and the Bush administration and Republican members of Congress and some blue dog mug wump lick-spittle Democrats to use September the 11th, 2001 as a means by which we started a war that is now 5 long years long. And God knows 50 to 100 5,000 dead and maimed American servicemen and women, and many other from many other countries, and a million, damn it, dead Iraqi civilians. And it is all, every last bloody, filthy, unholy bit of it, the product of a criminal conspiracy by which one or more persons agreed to commit an illegal act, and one or more, or two or more people, and then one or more of those people took substantial steps toward the furtherance of the goal of the conspiracy. Iraq is an illegal war. It was an illegal war. It is an illegal occupation. It is a felony. George Bush should be tried for it, and he should be imprisoned for it for the rest of his natural born life. Because I don't believe in the death penalty. So should Condi Rice. So should Colin Powell. So should Donald Rumsfeld. So should Dick Cheney. So should Richard Pearl. So should Paul Wolfowitz. And on and on and on. So that we could make that vow that you often hear in describing the Holocaust. Never again. There was a lot of never againing that went on after Vietnam. Sorry. Because the bastards who did Vietnam were not driven out of civil society and shunned as lepers wherever they went. Okay, I'll stop with the little black hats and the little black boots. Point taken, and I will do it. That was just, no excuses. No excuses. Meanwhile, just to sort of bring things full circle, there is a young man who will be tried for his life this summer. He will have no jury. He will have no judge. His prosecutor will not operate under anything resembling American rules of evidence or criminal procedure. His name is Omar Khadr. At the age of 15, he was caught fighting in Afghanistan. He is charged with throwing a grenade during a battle at an American soldier. He will, as I said, be tried for his life. During attempts to get him to confess, he was dragged into his interrogation room at Bagram Air Force Base and later at Guantanamo Bay. When he had recovered somewhat, and he was repeatedly threatened with rape. You know, because the worst thing a fine, upstanding member of the American military can think of to do to somebody is to threaten to game up real good. That's how sick and twisted we are, you see. Repeatedly threatened with rape. One time, when he was left in an isolation cell and could do nothing else, he urinated on himself. Omar Khadr did. For that, he was doused with Pine Sol, and his head was used as a mop by American service personnel. And the Pentagon said, well, we can't find any evidence of it. All we've got is his word. Yeah, because, you know, the people who did it, go, oh, yeah, I did it. Yeah, that's me. I was the mopping guy. Now, I was the guy who threatened to rape him. Whew. and Omar Khadr is a victim of the criminal conspiracy that is Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm looking at the face of a victim of a criminal conspiracy. There was a conspiracy. Let's go to the phones. Hey, John.
Hey, Bob. How are you? I just wanted to kind of slide in on to follow up from Andy's call, and I think that this is, you know, the whole, you know, 9/11 truth movement and everything that's happened since September 11, 2001 has been so unbelievably divisive in this country. And I understand the emotion that comes from all sides. And I think it comes down to we have been lied to so consistently and manipulated so well. And the list of crimes is so long. The fact that we have had no accountability, it feeds this stuff. And I'm not, and I don't actually bag the 9/11 truth movement. I happen to think it's a situation where, you know, we still don't bloody know. The 9/11 commission was a sham. Now, I'm not going around, you know, supporting any particular theories. That's not what I'm on about.
No, I understand.
But I understand where, you know, Andy's obviously been looking at this hard. I've looked at it unbelievably hard, you know, over the years, and I've watched every bloody, you know, homemade movie, rah, 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 about it, you know, since it took place. And I have to tell you, on the day, it all just seemed really squirrely to me. And I, you know, when you look at things like, you know, there are crucial things that really need to be looked at honestly. The scrambling of the fighters. Now, I have a real hard time believing that was purely incompetence. Because, you know, we have a golfer's private jet go off course for a little while, and, you know, the fighters are all over it, you know. And I think it's this incredible mistrust that we now have as a population that there are so many unanswered questions that, yeah, I think some people kind of, you know, your water comment makes so much sense that, you know, it's going to follow the easiest path. And I think sometimes we lose track of the quest for the truth, unfortunately, because there's so much emotion involved in all this. I mean, you know, you look at Kissinger, you know, the last guy in the world I'd ever trust to look for the truth in anything when it comes to the U.S. government or actually investigate anything, you know, got dumped because of a business conflict of interest. You know, so I think this is so difficult and the emotions run so high because the American people and many people across the world have become to just not trust anything.
And to believe that the Bush administration is capable of anything, John. And you know, I pride myself on saying I'm wrong when I'm wrong, and I trust Andy's gut on this a lot. And maybe my objection to the people in the so-called 9/11 truth movement, who are obviously hucksters, has been deemed or perceived as carrying over to genuine inquiry into what happened. And I can understand, and it's easily, looking back now with hindsight, John, it's easy for me to comprehend that, because there are people who take the fact that I goon on right-wing religion industry types as being some sort of an indictment of Christianity, when it's not. And no matter how hard I try to make that clear, some people still don't get it. But it's possible that it seems to me that that's what's happened with this as well. I don't believe that everyone who says, I don't trust the official government version of 9/11, is a so-called conspiracy theorist or a nut, because that would make me a nut.
I don't think that the term conspiracy theory had, you know, I think it's been, you know, it's been blackened. I mean, just yesterday I was in the local, our local grocery store, and this organic coffee that we've been buying for over a year, and we're not the only ones that bought it, seemed to just disappear from the shelves, and the tag was gone, and it, you know, kind of took up a little bit of space in amongst all the Nestle stuff. And I walked in, and I saw the Nestle reps in there, you know, moving tags and redoing their bought shelf space. And I said, ah, I bet you guys are the ones that made my organic coffee disappear. And the guy immediately went, oh, go believe whatever conspiracy theories you want. And there is, you know, a tendency for people to, you know, use conspiracy theory as a negative terminology.
Well, they use it as a shorthand for saying you are insane and not to be believed.
Right. Exactly. You know, and with this guy, you know, I got on to him about Nestle and their activities in Africa. He goes, that was 45 years ago. I go, what about Ethiopia last year? And the guy just got in my face. And I looked at him and I said, mate, those tactics won't work with me. I'm far better educated than you would ever want to believe. And even the most educated, research-intensive people, when you're not seeing any action to answer unanswered questions and constant stonewalling, you are going to end up having people get off the track. And I do believe that there are people who take on this movement for not-so-honest reasons. As you say, you know, you use the term hucksters. And I do think that there are some people, just like in any movement, it happens in the green movement, you know, it happens in almost every movement, that there's going to be someone who's going to pick it up to try and discredit it for any credibility that it may have. You know, I feel so for the families who had, you know, the debris just pulled out, shipped off to a landfill.
Or China.
Before it could be investigated.
Yeah. I mean, we go 300 feet deep in the ocean and recover enough parts of an aircraft to rebuild the aircraft in a hangar. And we couldn't find a place to try to put and at least, you know, so the American people could be satisfied. Oh, that, you know, sure, that stinks and it makes you look twice. But all I'm trying to say, to get back to that water analogy, is that I've argued so many times that these people are punks and thugs that it's a lot easier for me to see them just ignoring the evidence before their eyes and saying, boy, are we going to make hay on this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, a couple of years ago, I was blogging very heavily on the questions and the different, you know, speculative theories that were put out. And I had a good friend of mine, a fellow blogger, email me saying, Nate, you gotta stop doing this. And I'm saying, well, why? And he said, you're gonna damage your credibility. And we went back and forth on this. And I said, but I reckon if I'm not asking the questions that to me look completely unanswered, I'm not doing my so-called job as a blogger. And, you know, okay, if someone wants to attack me, I never said that this is what happened. But, you know, I'd report, this physicist has just, you know, reported this. What do you reckon? Why aren't we talking about this? And once again, in America, if the conversation is too difficult, it gets shut down by those who don't want to have it.
There is truth in that, John. There is inestimable truth in that. And, you know, the proof of that is, for instance, let's say you and I want to talk about what I just mentioned, the criminal conspiracy that resulted in the Iraqi occupation. And somewhere along the way, I say, oh, and by the way, the planes were remote controlled.
What planes? The ones on 9/11. Now, no matter how cogent the arguments are that I have made in favor of viewing the Iraq war and the Iraq occupation as a criminal conspiracy, I will lose all credibility the instant I talk about the remote-controlled airplanes or the bombs under the fuselage.
Absolutely. It's gone on so long, and I think this is where it's festered so badly that it's become a poisoned topic. And
it is. It is poisonous. I mean, the idea that I have somehow hurt one of my listeners by just a flippant off the cuff remark is gnawing at my soul right now, John. I think here on the horn we're a little bit different from the average air personality, you know, because we're real and we recognize that our listeners and our callers are real. And I cannot stand the idea that I got Andy upset and I woke up Hazel. Because, see, I, for all of my agnosticism, or whatever one cares to call it, I have a very real definition of sin, and I have just committed one. Because in elegance of speech, I have hurt someone that I care about. And that's a sin.
Absolutely. You know, one of my favorite things to watch, I have to say, is Real Time with Bill Maher. But I was really mad at him with the way he treated the 9/11 Truth Movement. Now, I do think that they, as guests of a program, acted a little bit, shall we say, childish maybe, but unfortunately, those actions ended up closing off someone like Bill Maher to any discussion of the topic from here on out.
And see, in a way, that's what's happened to me. Because if you want to talk about how the building fell, that's fine. When buildings fall in certain ways, and we can have discussions of the physics that make buildings come down. But that's not the people I'm talking about. I'm talking about the people who talk about remote-controlled aircraft, who, when I ask them, you know, about the people on, you know, the passengers on the aircraft, because I had one of these goobers on the show. See, I did it again. And I asked him about the people on the, about the people on the aircraft, and he told me about a bus to Louisville. And the guy was on the show to sell a movie. Not to give a movie away. No, baby. Sell a movie. Okay?
And this is where, you know, you have to be really, really careful. You know, and it's also, you know, anyone can get caught up in a wave of anything as well. No matter how good your intentions are and how right you may be to ask the questions that you're asking, you know, you get, it happens on the right wing, it happens, you know, on our side, you know, you can get into an echo chamber and then you end up feeding and you lose the plot of what you're going for in the to begin with, I think.
Yeah, you do. And again, it, this feeds into some of the suspicion. I'm not going to say paranoia, because it's not paranoia. It is suspicion. By virtue of the remote-controlled aircraft people and some of the other stranger postulations that I've seen put out there, it is possible for people to completely give up on 9/11, September 11th, 2001. I'm one of those people. Because you can't have a cogent discussion about it. Because sooner or later, somebody's going to tell you about the remote-controlled aircraft. Or the Masons did it. Or...
You know, it's a real hard one for me. I I am just too curious and I have way too many questions. But it's a dialogue that I've come to not necessarily avoid, but I just keep my eye out for new information that I can get. But because of whether it was incompetence or a conscious effort, the ability to get to the bottom of what may have actually happened on the day had been destroyed.
Yeah,
like you said,
and it forecloses legitimate inquiry. Oh well, we had a you know, look, I remember that the first guy that George Bush wanted to put on the 9/11 commission was Henry Flippin' Kissinger. And that he had to be dragged kicking and screaming to that. I remember that.
And it was the families. It was the families that actually made that happen.
Yeah. So
they confronted him and brought the facts before him and the press and the public. And very quietly, he steps down. And, you know, I mean, Tom Keene, my former governor, who I still actually have quite a bit of respect for till this day for what he did for New Jersey when I was, when I was a young lad, changing the image of New Jersey from being the United States, landfill to a prosperous out-of-debt state, and he did do a good job. He has been very, very open in saying, we were stopped at every single, there were roadblocks put in between us and our investigation on a consistent basis. The guy who helped front the investigation.
Lord Jesus, when George Bush testified my rear end, when George Bush went to have an informal chat with the commission, he couldn't do it without Dick Cheney. What the hell are we supposed to think?
And regardless of, that he's the president, he is still accountable to the law of the land. No other person would be allowed to go and have a conversation as opposed to actually testify under oath. And this, again, is another one of these things that's going to feed people's suspicions. And if you keep feeding their suspicions, we're going to end up we end up in the situation that we're in now.
Yeah, we do.
Been a long damn 8 years.
Yeah, it has, and I got a little secret for you. It's a long way to January too, because I reiterate, John, what you're seeing now, like with the Bear Stearns business, and I wish I could read a link that was about 9 miles long. I found the world's most useful PowerPoint presentation today that explained Bear Stearns using stick figures, and it's genius. I'll try to ship it to Ninja Susan and see if she can get it, because people need to see this. But that's a criminal conspiracy, and what we're seeing is these people, and I use this barnyard analogy, thinking that somehow it'll resonate, but if you've ever seen hogs at the trough and seen them trying to get their feet in the trough because they just want to get there where they can get to the last little bit, what we are witnessing is watching a hog trying to get its back feet in the trough too. And it is going to be lots of hogs trying to get those back trotters into the trough from now until January. Because they're afraid that their time at the trough is coming to an end, and they're going to become skinny hogs again real soon. But they won't, because they're the rich. They'll be a little leaner and meaner.
And one of the things that's really worrying me is, we've talked about the inter-bickering between, Obama and Clinton is starting to resonate badly with the American people. And, the things we've talked about are starting to pan out. There's polls now showing that McCain is actually polling higher than either candidate. Now, I actually think that will change once the convention's over, because this either-or situation ends up, I think, confusing the results a bit. But I'm very, very afraid that if we don't get focused on McCain, which I think Obama's trying to do, I think he is trying to do from what I've been watching over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to do as the Democrats have done so many times in the past, lost the election by their own doing.
Or simply by not trying. I mean,
Anyway, man, I'm gonna let you go. I just wanted to, you know, the emotion of the debate, I think, has to be, you know, we have to think about the emotion of the debate when discussing folks that are part of the movement, and that there is legitimacy to the movement, but filtering out those that may be hucksters and verifiable fact from, you know, just trying to come up with an answer that seems to add up.
Yeah. So,
let you go, man. Enjoy the rest of the show. Thanks for the time. We'll see.
Oh, my pleasure, John. And I'll catch you on the horn section here in a little bit.
All right, man. Bye-bye.
All right, later. It's tough. It's a hard, hard issue. And I guess for me, I want to, I don't know. You know, I have never stopped anybody on this program from talking about 9/11. I've never denigrated anybody who wanted to talk about 9/11. I just don't want to. And I don't want to because I don't want to reach that point where I get told about the remote-controlled airplanes again. Because I can't guarantee that I will keep it together when that happens. And water seeks its own level, and it takes the path of least resistance. And it's a lot easier to just sit there and let the planes go and know that you're going to capitalize on it in ways that people cannot even imagine. And I think it makes things, it makes more sense to me. Sorry, we're dealing with my perception of reality and yours as well. And I'm sorry, Andy. I am truly, truly, truly sorry, because I call you friend and I do not hurt my friends. Now, some of the stuff we didn't get to today that I'd like to get to. Hillary Clinton was in Charleston today. Hillary Clinton was asked about mountaintop removal. And I think you might find this interesting. She was interviewed. This is obviously a telephone interview by Beth Voorhees. Beth Voorhees is with West Virginia Public Radio. And Beth Voorhees asked her the token mountaintop removal question. Because I have talked about Barack Obama's comments on wanting to turn West Virginia into a vast and trackless wasteland that he calls the Saudi Arabia of coal, I think it's only fair that you hear Hillary Clinton and her response to a question regarding mountaintop removal. She was, Senator Clinton was here at two events today, one in Huntington and one in Charleston. Tomorrow, Barack Obama will be at an event in Charleston and an event in Beckley. I've sent an email off to my friends at Coal River Mountain Watch asking, please, for someone who goes to the events to call in and do reporter duty on what was said and what was heard. And I hope that will come to fruition. We will also be talking most likely tomorrow night with J.W. Randolph,
who, among other things, blogs at Appalachian Voices and has written some good stuff on both candidates and the opportunities that dealing with mountaintop removal presents. Here now, Hillary Clinton and Beth Voorhees.
Great reserve of coal. And,
let me back it up a bit.
We get more than 50%. Well, coal fits in very importantly because, obviously, we have a great reserve of coal, and we get more than 50% of our electricity from coal. The challenge is how we're going to continue using coal and meet a lot of our environmental challenges. And what I have said is that we'll have a new cap-and-trade system, and we'll take a lot of the money that we get from that cap-and-trade system and invest it in new forms of energy, including clean coal technology. Right away, I have been advocating that we fund 10 large-scale carbon capture and storage projects that would utilize a range of coal types and power plant types and storage locations, because it's imperative that we do everything we can to get to a technology that enables us to use clean coal, that supports, you know, the subsidies for coal to liquids projects that meet that environmental standard that I think we can set. And I'm excited because if we started on it today, we would have some answers soon. But you saw where the Bush administration just canceled their big coal project in Illinois for reasons that I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
So we are just dragging our feet instead of doing what we all know we need to do to make sure that coal plays a major role but does it in the right way.
Okay, coming up, the mountaintop removal obligatory question from Beth Voorhees. Worked both of the pro-coal talking points into that sentence, didn't she? Clean coal and coal to liquids. I guess there's a perception that us hillbillies are just sitting around waiting for the day, sort of like the people in Idiocracy with their Brondo, when it's all just liquid coal. I guess. So let's continue to the mountaintop removal question.
Do you have a position on mountaintop removal mining?
Well, I'm concerned about it for all the reasons people state, but I think it's a difficult...
I'm concerned about it for all the reasons people state. Senator Clinton, with all due respect, do you know what those reasons are? Let's find out.
The question, because of the conflict between the economic and environmental trade-offs that you have here, and
see, somebody, some advisor somewhere has told her that there's an economic and environmental trade-off involved with mountaintop removal. That's a lie. Not saying Senator Clinton's lying, but she has been fed one. Mountaintop removal results in less jobs and higher poverty, not more jobs and more prosperity. It's not a trade-off. The misery goes hand in hand with mountaintop removal, Senator.
You know, I'm not an expert. I don't know enough to have an independent opinion, but I sure would like people who could be objective, understanding both the economic...
People who could be objective. See, I just got written off because I lack objectivity. And everybody in the Coal River Valley who's had their wells poisoned, their homes destroyed, their communities ruined, their lungs blackened, well, they don't have sufficient objectivity now, do they? Because they're biased against mountaintop removal, because mountaintop removal is killing them. So, yeah, you know what I mean.
Necessities and the environmental damage, you know, to come up with some approach.
Hold on, let's back it up here. Let's get the whole thing.
But I think it's a difficult question because of the conflict between the economic and environmental trade-offs that you have here. And, you know, I'm not an expert. I don't know enough to have an independent opinion, but I sure would like people who could be objective, understanding both the economic necessities and the environmental damage, you know, to come up with some approach that would enable us to retrieve the coal, but do it in a way that wouldn't damage the you know, living standards and the other important.
Pardon me for a minute. Retrieve the coal? Makes the coal sound like a duck we shot over a lake. Retrieve the coal? Okay, I backed it up a little bit. I don't want to just lose context.
Sure would like people who could be...
Oh, by the way, she said she's not an expert. She's been sitting in on hearings on mountaintop removal since 2002. She's been a part of hearings regarding mountaintop removal since 2002. Just saying.
Objective, understanding both the economic necessities and the environmental damage, you know, to come up with some approach that would enable us to retrieve the coal, but do it in a way that wouldn't damage the you know, living standards and the other important qualities associated with people living both under the mountaintop and people who are along the streams. You know, maybe there is a way to recover those mountaintops once they have been stripped of the coal. I just think we've got to...
Maybe there's a way to recover the mountaintops after we've retrieved the coal? There's the law already says that the mountain has to be returned to its natural contours. That's not working out real well. Poor thing. Poor Obama. Their advisors have told them to be careful what they say about this when they come here, because there are people like Don Blankenship and the rest of the coal mob that have money to burn to oppose them, and they will use it. And they'd both of them like to actually carry West Virginia. And they've been told by our senators and by our members of Congress that West Virginia's just itching to have them some liquid coal. Yeehaw! Get the jug, boy! Let's have us a swag!
Get this from a practical perspective.
You've been...
And then she goes on to talk about the steel business. She can't... You know, I think if you had her one-on-one and said, listen, this is off the record, Senator, you don't support this, do you? And I think if you had Obama one-on-one and said, listen, you know, you don't really support this, do you? I mean, this is contrary to every value any Democrat should possibly have. You don't support destroying West Virginia so that Atlanta can leave its lights on at night, do you? You don't support that, do you, Senator? And I think both of them, Obama and Clinton, would say, well, no, not really. I mean, that? No, hell, who would support that? But they can't, because this is the American filthied up, moneyed up, bribed up political process that says you dare not say anything that the big money boys don't like. Yeah, I had an email with that quote in it. Came from Joy, quoting Hillary with all that you just heard, asking simply, is she nuts? No, sad to say, it would be easier to explain if she were nuts. What she is terrified. Just like Barack Obama is terrified. Keep an eye out in the next couple of days over at Huffington Post for a new piece coming out from Jeff Biggers. I think you'll be fascinated with what he has to offer. It may already be there. I don't know.
but he's talking about a new Green Deal. And I think it's something we should pay very, very close attention to. I hope we'll get a call in from Beckley or Charleston or both tomorrow, and I look forward to hearing from J.W. Randolph, whose Appalachian Voices blog put me onto that audio. If you want to, go back and listen to Senator Clinton's speech, or Senator Clinton's interview, rather, with Beth Voorhees, you can do so by going to App Voices, appvoices.org, and look for the Front Porch blog, and look for a blog titled Hillary Clinton on MTR. You can hear it for yourself without me interrupting it and blabbing all over the place. I want to thank those who are chipping in as we move toward the tail end of March. We are only about $1,000 away from our monthly goal, $1,000 away from kicking the wolf off the porch for a few more days. Sure would be nice to get the wolf way the hell out of the yard, too. There's a PayPal button at our website, headonradionetwork.com. There's also a link underneath the PayPal buttons that takes you to our mailing address, Head On, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, P as in Paul, M as in Mary, B as in boy, PMB, stands for personal mailbox, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. Any way you care to help, we are terribly, terribly grateful to have that help. Up next, a brand spanking new Strictly Confidential with Peter Godbold, who is back from babysitting a sick server. And he's raring to go. Thanks to John Fox. Enjoyed our conversation tonight. Look forward to more on the horn section. Thanks to Ben Birch, who needs your help as well at whiterosesociety.org so that what he streams of the horn, which is everything, he can continue to do. Sorry, this is a little bit of a resource-intensive process, far more so than your average text site. Thanks to all the hardworking folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Be part of that solution. Be part of Coal River Mountain Watch, because they're doing mighty good work. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Gather around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbulb.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome, welcome indeed to book, chapter, and verse 127 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. You'll find Coal River Mountain Watch at crmw.net. CRMW.net for Coal River Mountain Watch. Stop by and have a look at what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Wednesday, March 19, 2008. And if you are listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on a Wednesday evening that is March the 19th, you are listening to a live show, and you're indeed welcome to call in and participate with myself and the two guests that I'll be introducing shortly. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests, their previous shows. The audio archives are there. You'll find links to the chat room, which is active as I speak. I always like to point out the chat room is very much a part of the Head On Radio Network. It is active during all of the live programming that you hear on this network, and you'll find some of the smartest and most entertaining people on the whole planet in the Strictly Confidential or Head On Radio Network chat room. You'll find links to the chat room at strictlyconfidentialradio.com or over at headonradionetwork.com. Speaking of headonradionetwork.com, you'll find links there to the PayPal button. That should be right there on the home page. As I say, we are listener-supported, and your contributions are not only needed, they are appreciated. These funds that you contribute go to the physical facility, as in keeping the hard drive spinning and the packets passing and the cassettes cassetting and the VUs VUing and the microphones listening and all of the things that have to happen in a studio in order to produce a program like this or any of the other programs on the Head On Radio Network. Also at strictlyconfidentialradio.com, you'll find links to the main site, and there are links there to the Head On Radio Network schedule. And you can find out about all the other progressive programming on this network, of which I am only a very, very small part. You'll also find links to Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. Wow, it's nice to be back. I have spent a couple of days nursing along a mail server that... Well, the best I could put it to you, it was the mail server crisis from hell. You know, I had to laugh while I was doing it, though. It became amusing to me at some point of all the lost emails that the Bush administration has deliberately lost by not implementing a standard backup routine. Apparently there's no care or concern. In fact, they're violating laws of archiving presidential records. But nonetheless, they have carefully and explicitly lost thousands of